nice flavor, but I'm tossing fire, leaving Babylon, and trying to escape this Utah. Who child, it's time to jungle, it's too wild. That's why we got more than two stars. Two adept in the situation, too sharp. And though the road is rocky, I'm ready to try the next mile to bring sight to the blind man. It's down to the left child, we will survive. It is time to build a nest. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Jungleist, specialist, predator and survivalist. Splitting heaven, fire from his lips. Burning slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. But we as a people will turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, wisdom is the principal thing, therefore get wisdom. All that getting an understanding. Again, welcome to the program this evening with your host, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to get involved in the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live audio at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream at that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. We're streaming live at abibitumi.com. That's abibitumi.com/timeforanawakening. They stream from Ghana. Or you can download the TuneIn Radio app to any of your devices. TuneIn Radio is a free radio app. In the TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you had a Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with a live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. That's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, you can type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you'll always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And do me a favor, before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for an Awakening media is also there. Always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening media, interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, and share with your friends. And also check out that Time for an Awakening marketplace and our partnership with Abibitumi. Always interesting things in the marketplace all the time. Various African language classes, classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more being taught by professors on both the continent and in the diaspora. So again, make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. It's 7:08 on this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening, the Sunday, February the 25th edition of Time for an Awakening. Our guests scheduled this evening in conversation, author and professor of politics and African American studies at the University of San Francisco, Dr. James Lance Taylor, is scheduled to join us this evening. As a member of the San Francisco African-American Reparations Advisory Committee, Dr. Taylor will update our listening audience on the California reparations movement and exactly what's going on presently. We'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening at 7:13 here in this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. Before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here at Philadelphia at 79th Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard?
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm doing fine. You know, we just, I have to shout out, Elliot, that, you know, the gathering we just had of members of NCOBRA was really invigorating, I guess. And it helped me just remember how much people, ordinary people, make commitment to our future, you know. So with that said, I'm doing fine.
Yeah, it was good to see all of the folks there, the folks that were recognized. Also, Brianna and Michonne, the work that they're doing as the, what you call it, the third generation, Richard?
Yes.
Yeah, so it was good to see them there and to recognize them also for their work, and they turn around and recognize some of the folks that was pioneers in the organization here in Philadelphia. So it was good all the way around.
So it fits right in, with the discussion we will have tonight as far as just looking over, what is it that we're, how do you build the next generation of leadership? And the difference, one thing that, and it was heartfelt in the sense of, leaders are, I asked the elder one time, are leaders are made or born? And he said both. And I think in our system, we get to see how that plays out, right? You can intentionally build people to have leadership capability. And then on the same time, you can have people who come at the right time to provide leadership that you didn't even know existed before they showed themselves. So that's another thing, we have to be conscious of, which is a part of our history, right? Having the faith that the good work will be rewarded by the continuation of good work.
You made a good statement there when you talked about the leaders being cultivated and leaders just folks just appearing at the right time. And you were saying that in reference to both Rashawn and Brianna.
Right.
And the work that they're achieving now. And also Sister Cassie. Who's going to be dealing with the communications.
That was an interesting connection too, to find that their family member and your connection with them, and even unknowing the connection to Rashawn in relationship to continuing that network process. I thought that all of this coming out of, which raises another thing, Elliot, coming out of study groups, the importance of study. And not just in relationship to the information, but in relationship to the networking, building between people about the information, especially about the information as it relates to us. And here later on, people are identifying each other that didn't even know they knew each other.
Listen, Richard, I didn't, and we talking a little bit to give Dr. Taylor a little bit of time, because I know last week he was a little confused about the time. So let's see what happens this week. Richard, you mentioned something a minute ago there about the importance of study groups. And if you look, and I just thought about that when you just mentioned it. If you look at some of the people that made moves for our people, I'm talking about from the beginning. And when I say from the beginning, I'm talking about our experience here with Europeans till till the present. They were involved in some type of study groups. Look at Denmark Vesey. That was a study group there.
Right.
Look at I just had a brain freeze. That passed away up there in Boston. That was with Mariah Stewart. David Walker. Look at David Walker. They came out of a study group.
Mm-hmm.
He mentioned it in his book.
Mm-hmm.
And Nat Turner. He had a study group. All of those men were groupings. They were going over information, looking at their situation, mapping out maybe escape routes. It was study groups that a lot of those men came out of.
Mm-hmm. The Panthers, Huey and Bobby, they were a part of a study group.
I didn't think about that until you just mentioned it. But maybe it's a correlation there. Maybe it's a tie.
And you know, Elliot, as you bring that up, because what is, I mean, even when we put it, and this is important, you know, how important it is to place, well, place thing in historical context, black people's historical context. Because what, I mean, before the Civil War, what was the primary thing that they felt was important? Education. And what did they, what propped up, you know, what propped up, as you say, study groups, they called them literary societies. What was the primary thing once the political power after, you know, the war, the Civil War, what was the, I mean, really gave this to, you know, as a political agenda, public education. And I was just going over, a text where, you know, when we talk about from 1870 through 1880, the type of classical education they want, they wasn't getting an education for a job. They said they were educated. They wanted a curriculum to educate, to produce leaders. And the curriculum where, you know, arithmetic, algebra, geometry, map making, you know, dealing with the physiology, I mean, writing, or, you know, the whole thing of oratory. I mean, this is black folks. And I think it ties to the point of study groups, but it ties to the point of producing leaders. And leaders doesn't have to be the person that's the general, right? And producing leaders that reinforce our worldview. I think that that's like a continuity. But now today, when we say what we want education, it gets a little mixed for me, a little mixed, because everybody's talking about they want their children to go to school so they can get educated, so they can get a job. That's not to say, I don't think that that was our development of why it was important to be educated was not necessarily to get a job, especially get a job by somebody else who created the job. They wanted to, and they said it, they wanted to be able to get educated so that they could be able to create the leadership that would create the economy to be able to govern a people.
Yeah, to govern themselves. Yeah. They stated it clearly when they spoke with that general. When I read that proclamation, when Jared Ball was with us,
right.
They stated it clearly what they want. They wanted land. They wanted to be separate because they didn't think that they was going to be able to live around whites, and they wanted to govern themselves.
Right.
And
sometimes people get it all confused because they think. Soon, as a matter of fact, I was just in a discussion Friday, and when we said, govern yourself or nation building, the sister asked, well, are you saying to be separate from the political? Like, what do you mean by self-governing? It's like we have to be able to perceive we can govern ourselves, and it has nothing to do with the tools that of the system that we're in. We can use them. I mean, a hammer could be sitting there. A hammer doesn't determine what we do, but we can use a hammer to hit a nail. And it's just the same thing with being, but self-governance, you know, I guess I'm in this moment emphatic about it because how much things get conflated in our conversations, in our expressions, and how fearful we get. I mean, you say self-governance or create a political party, an independent party. I don't know. I might be wrong, Elliot. I think black folks get scared, real scared when you say that.
Well, listen, what did Dr. Carter say a couple of weeks ago when she was on? About the fear and apprehension is there, the anxiety among black folks looking at these situations. almost like we need to, listen, I don't want to say it like that, but some of our people, and I'd like to say a small percentage of our people, feel that they need white folks to guide them.
Mm. And see how it all lines up, you know, Elliot, and that's what I'm saying about being conflated. Cause we sound like that. Like we have no, what's so scary, which goes back to the reason why study is so important and effective communication is so necessary, because we can't even fathom today. It's today. It's something that's happened maybe over the last 50, 70 years where black folks feel to get educated, being redundant, is to get a job. And we know who's producing the jobs. Who sets the criteria for getting a job? Who sets the criteria for, what type of business you're going into? Who sets the criteria what party you should support? And white folks supposedly put out there, they were telling themselves that these people can't govern themselves. They need us. Even the pacifists, even the ones that were supposed to be allies, you know, whether you call them Quakers or benevolent, they all took this paternalistic position.
Yes, exactly.
That black folks could not do for themselves, and we got to help them. I might be wrong, Elliot.
I mean, history points that out. You can see it. That even if you had some that was supposedly friends, they didn't look at, they'd almost look at you like a child that needs help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Richard, while we're waiting on Dr. Taylor to join us, and this time if he calls in late, we'll just get him on here and then spend some time with him. But one of the things that I want to run by him as a political scientist is not only the independent political parties and the moves that are being made across the country, you know, and I'm saying that in reference to Mississippi on the Move and the Black Liberation Movement down there. Down there on Monday, they announced it on Thursday on their program that on Monday in Greenville, Mississippi, which is in the Delta, it's the seventh leg or the sixth leg, if Brother Patrick is listening, he'll probably call in, of their 10-city town talk. So they've been moving all around the state, feeling the pulse of the people, talking about the importance of organizing and organizing politically to try to take control of areas where they overpopulate and dwell.
Right.
So it's a 10-city tour that has been organized so far, and I think this is the sixth leg. Monday they'll be in Greenville, Mississippi. Now, these things are going on in the state of Mississippi, where you have Benny Thompson and the other black elected officials, and you don't hear anything about it or any acknowledgement about it from him, from other black elected officials, even in the city of Jackson, or on certain black talk radio programs. It's like it's not going on. It's like it don't exist. There's something wrong with that picture, Richard. Is something wrong with that picture? Because anything our people are doing here, it should be announced to others so people can get a full scope and a full picture of exactly what's going on. Because mm-hmm. this media will always announce negative things that our that some of our people do. That'll be plastered all over the national news, not only just local news.
Mm. Yeah, and the vehicle, you know, we were talking about different moments and again different leaders and our, you know, and trying to assess, but you know, like I don't know, does it have to be something that white folks don't like before it's picked up where black folks are supposed to become aware of it. You know, we talk about the black press or the black communication network. Does it all, I mean, can we see things in its beginning and communicate about it as it grows? And that, like you said, a seven, what's that, city or county tour? I mean, if two people show up, but and you intentionally went through those, that is a big thing. And I know more than two people are showing up.
Yes, I think it's the sixth leg of the 10-city town talk tour all throughout Mississippi in the different quadrants. In fact, some of the leadership of the organization is from different quadrants in Mississippi, the way they've broken it down.
And their leader, they're already, what makes it beautiful and why it's important to you know, that you raise this, because those people are already organizing in their area, so they're connecting with those people, so it ain't just two people, because there's already people working there that's been working there, and they're down, those people are connecting with other people from other places. So, and I'm only saying that because to me, that is newsworthy. Now, if it was that when, what's her name in Georgia, when she was moving, you know, to be governor, and they can move around there, that became an item.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't the question of the activity. It's the question of who's doing the activity.
Who's doing it and what they're doing. Because when right. Stacey Abrams was moving around, in Georgia, she was trying to organize people for the Democratic Party.
There you go.
She wasn't organizing people to vote independent, organizing black enclaves to really look at their situation and develop candidates to expressly deal with their situation, which is different than any other nationality here in this United States. It wasn't like that. She was organizing people to follow the tenets of the Democratic Party. So that became national news. And then she parlayed that into other things, like when she went over there and became an observer status on what was going on in Nigeria.
Yeah, how you do that? How you do that?
Okay. Richard, let me, you know, one of the reasons why I brought that up and use Mississippi on the Move as an example, I want to go back and just read that, because I got it right in front of me. Read that declaration that was declared during the National Black Political Convention in Gary in 72, and what they stated. Because what they stated here, Richard, it's not any different in 2024. In fact, it's worse. I think it has gotten worse. Now, let me read what they stated here. You're familiar with it, and some of our listening audience may or may not be, but this was a declaration that came out of the 72 convention. It says, 72 National Black Political Convention. It says, for more than a century, we have followed the path of political dependence on white men and their systems. From the Liberty Party in the decades before the Civil War, to the Republican Party of Abraham Lincoln, we trusted in white men and white politics as our deliverers. 60 years ago, W.E.B. Du Bois said he would give the Democrats their last chance to prove their sincere commitment to equality for black people. And he was given white riots and official segregation in peace and in war. Nevertheless, some 20 years later, we became Democrats in the name of Franklin Roosevelt, then supported his successor, Harry Truman, and even tried a nonpartisan Republican general of the army named Eisenhower. We were wooed, like many others, by the superficial liberalism of John Kennedy and the make-believe populism of Lyndon Johnson. Let there be no more of that. Both parties have betrayed us. Here in Gary, let us forget that while the times and names of the parties have continually changed, one truth has faced us insensibly, never changing. Both parties have betrayed us, and whatever their interests conflict, whenever their interests conflicted with ours, which is most of the time, and whenever our forces were unorganized, dependent, and compliant, nor should they be surprising. Hold it, let me read that again. Both parties have betrayed us whenever their interests conflicted with ours, which was most of the time. And whenever our forces were unorganized and dependent and compliant. For by now we must know that America's political system, like all other white institutions in America, was designed to operate for the benefit of the white race. It was never meant to do anything else. Richard, prophetic words that ring true now. And it was true in 72. But you still hear some of our people, especially during these national elections, talking about the lesser of two evils, what you're going to do. We got you hold your nose and vote Democratic. You got to vote Democratic. Do you see what these men were trying to get across to the people then? The message still rings true now.
Yeah. And that was, like you said, 72, when the ideal was once again, you know, you had mentioned after, you know, during Reconstruction, once again, in order to deal with moving towards self-governance. And again, I'm emphasizing, I hope people don't get conflated what that means. I mean, and I hope even as we are having this discussion about it, that we can become clear about what does it mean? Why is it such a create such a taboo? Is it because we are afraid? Or is it because there's a certain level of individuals within our general community who benefits more from the easy access to do within somebody else's system that we know and they know harms us as a group, but they individually can benefit from it, than what work and labor and sacrifice and critical thinking is necessary to put a system in place that will protect us on one hand and help us develop and strive on another? Is that it? That seems like that's too much work. That's too much sacrifice. That's too much personal sacrifice. As Dr. Francis Cress Welsing said, where we can continually define the problem, but never move towards problem resolution. Because that 72 statement sounds like a problem. It doesn't sound like it's stating a problem. It sounds like how we move to a resolution.
Well, exactly. And we know what happened during that period when you had sincere men that wanted to move towards a resolution, and then you had others involved that had other things in mind and that were being used by the system that they were fighting against. And it's the same thing going on now. You got a certain, and I hate using that term because that stuff has been started by Europeans, this class stuff. But you got a certain class of black folks that don't see nothing wrong with the status quo. And most of the black people failing and just a small percentage enjoying the fruits, so to speak.
Right.
Just as long as that the ones enjoying the fruits is them. Which basically boils down to assimilation. They don't see anything wrong with that.
Right.
I mean, how do you see that, Richard? Do you agree or what?
I'm triggered by the term assimilation, because as who was that? Lincoln. Lincoln said to those leaders, that wasn't about assimilation. He said, if they were like men like you, who basically act like white men.
You think like white men. That's what he said.
That's erasure. That's not assimilation is like you maintain yourself and we come together and, you know, and we work out something together. Erasure is I'm creating a process where whatever you think you are, whatever you thought you were, you are no longer that. You are what I make you to be. And if I can do that successfully, you will never even remember. You will never even think of. You will never even want to act like you really are. And therefore, you're almost, I mean, the point is that you're invisible. You're a ghost. The only difference is you're a ghost under my control.
Excuse me. Richard, I'm going to do this. I'm going to take a brief break and see if I can can reach out to Professor Taylor. You know, the odd thing about it, and I'll mention it to the, because I wanted to hold some things until we got some confirmation. But the odd thing about it, Richard, and I found it funny, I'm just telling it to the listening audience, Cornel West called up because he thought today was his day. And it's not. Dr. West is going to be joining us on the 24th of March. So mark that on your calendar. Cornel West will be with us on the 24th of March to talk about some of these things that's going on in people's minds now. Some of those folks love these dog and pony shows, but he'll be on to talk about that and tell the folks exactly why he's running and his platform. All those questions are going to be talked about and discussed on the program the 24th of March with Cornel West. But he got confused. He thought tonight was his night, and it wasn't. So
I was like, wait a minute. And you know what? I had just pulled up his agenda, Elliot, you know, because someone's asked Dr. Taylor about. And I said, oh, wait a minute. Hold it. Dr. West, not today. Are you supposed to be here? I was all confused.
Yeah, well, we'll.
It's all good.
Yeah, he'll be joining us on the 24th. Let me, if I can't reach him, then we'll move forward to open forum and just talk about some other issues. But right. What I'll do, I'll take a brief break and see what exactly was going on. Either way, we'll be prepared to move forward. We can take a brief break and you can join and be part of the discussion by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Time for an awakening. We'll be right back.
Host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Escape the digital plantation. IBBToMe.com, IBBToMe.TV, IBBToMeTV.com, IBBToMe.store are here for you. You are ready to be free of non-African social media. Don't run from danger, run to safety. IBBToMe.com is here for you. You are ready to be free of digital plantations to control your own products. IBBToMe.store is here for you. ABIBITUMI, Black Power, ABIBITUMI. The only word you need to know to join your global Commits You Black family, to join your interconnected Commits You Black communities. Escape the digital plantation now. IBBToMe.com, IBBToMe.TV, IBBToMeTV.com, IBBToMe.store. We are here for you. Escape the digital plantation.
A new era, a new phase of the struggle, where we have moved from a struggle for decency, which characterized our struggle for 10 or 12 years, to a struggle for genuine equality. And this is where we're getting the resistance, because there was never any intention to go this far. People were reacting to Bull Connor and to Jim Clark rather than acting in good faith for the realization of genuine equality.
Do you think white people in this country, and I'm talking about non-segregationists, people devoid or thinking they're devoid of racism, do you have any idea of what they want the Negro to be in America?
I think the vast majority of white Americans will go but so far. It's a kind of installment plan for equality, and they are always looking for an excuse to go but so far.
And know that this problem needs to be solved, and we can't keep relegating it to generation after generation because a few of us got a little money, a few of us got positions, a few of us have wealth, while the masses of our people are going steadily down. No one man can rise above the condition of his people. See, brother said responsibility. Is it that we should let them take responsibility to do for us, or should we pool the knowledge that's at the table, the power that's in our community, the wealth that's in our community, to change the harsh reality of black life in America? We have to do the job of fulfilling the black agenda.
Whites are expert game players in their contests to maintain absolute power. One of their time-honored gimmicks is to point to individual blacks who've achieved recognition. But look at Ralph Bunche. Think about Lena Horne or Marian Anderson. Look at Jackie Robinson. They made it as one of those who has made it. I would like to be thought of as an inspiration to our young. But I don't want them lied to. Name them for me. The examples of blacks who made it. For virtually everyone you name, I can give you a sordid piece of factual information on how they have been mistreated, humiliated. Not being able to fight back is a form of severe punishment.
And I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to the group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood.
For an Awakening is a proud part of the Black Talk Radio Network, the number one independent black digital and podcasting platform.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 7:50 on this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. our guest this evening in conversation, author, professor of politics and African American studies at the University of San Francisco, Dr. James Lance Taylor, will be joining us momentarily. As a member of the San Francisco African-American Reparations Advisory Committee, Dr. Taylor will update the listeners on the California reparations movement and what's going on, and also we'll transition into some of political talk that's kind of on the minds of a lot of our people. Bridget?
Yes.
Joining us in conversation here is Dr. James Lance Taylor. Dr. Taylor, what's going on? I thought the weather, you know, the weather been kind of bad out there in California. I didn't know whether the atmospheric river had you washed under.
You know what? It's been a mess out here, but it's cleared up in the last couple of days. But I definitely am off kilter, off balance, but I'm glad to be a part of the show today.
Glad to have you with us, Dr. Taylor. We've seen, you know. Listen, we've been following this almost from the beginning when you were first on talking about the plans of what was being done. We had Reverend Brown on a couple of times, which was the vice chair of the California Reparations Committee. He came on the last time when the document was finished and they passed it along to the lawmakers. And now we see some of the lawmakers are putting forth some bills. But we see, according to published reports, that no money is included in what's going on. Do we want you just to come on to kind of update our listeners on what exactly is going on with the bills after you and others have done a lot of the groundwork and passed this on to the lawmakers to kind of do their job? What's exactly going on in your opinion?
Well, that's a great lead-in and question. I think part of our challenge as a committee was that we probably had no business going to the state in the first place, asking for relief around reparations, because that's the offender. You know, we think it's the white people, but it was actually the state. And what black folk need to realize is that, you know, during the Reagan era, we got told that they were not slaveholders and we were not slaves and to leave it alone. And that worked until Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote an article in 2014, the case of reparations, and then that modernized the whole conversation and the whole debate in terms of bringing it, you know, forward to the mainstream. And, the California reparations movement was largely reflective of Ta-Nehisi Coates' arguments, which were not slavery, but everything after slavery, the other harms. And California didn't have a deep history of slavery for African Americans at all. It had a deep history of Indian slavery for 200 years. And most black folk don't realize that Indians were slaves for centuries too, here in California under the Spanish, under the Mexican sellouts or mestizos that were called the Californios, and then under the United States for, the United States allowed, once California became a part of the Union, it was a free state, but it allowed slaves to be brought in to work their mines in the 1840s and 50s. And to go back out, like, you couldn't stay here for more than 3 weeks with your slaves. You had to take them in and out. For us, the Reparations Committee, we put in a sincere effort. We weren't playing. We took our effort seriously. We hope that Black people appreciate that we took our effort seriously. We were not clowning. We didn't approach it thinking we can't do it and we should not try. We know there were a lot of skeptics in the Black community and a lot of opponents in the Asian and Latino and white community largely opposed reparations. But our efforts really had a powerful effect globally. San Francisco at that time was the largest city to attempt reparations. And it's the same city that gave us gay marriage and marijuana legalization. Or at least Oakland gave us marijuana legalization, but it was out here in the Bay Area. And what I think happened is that we inspired people. Like, we can't measure statistically or empirically the full impact that we had and have had on other people taking up reparations programs. In New York State, other than California, New York State, at the state level, at the legislative level, recently adopted a reparations program and plan, or at least committee, to try to establish a plan. Evanston, Illinois had been on the record, for some years ago. And it's been imperfect, but they keep tweaking it, trying to make it better. And that's the key. There's no perfect way to do reparations. Any example is going to be imperfect, and it's learn on the job, on the job training, trying to figure it out as you go. But Asheville, North Carolina, Oakland, California, Sacramento, California, Los Angeles, California, have all set up separate reparations committees apart from what we did in San Francisco. And in fact, in Oakland, last September, there was a school strike for weeks. And one of the 5 points they held out on was reparations. Oakland, Berkeley Unified School District has a reparations committee pursuing reparations separate from Berkeley the city. Sacramento, where Cornel West is from. And my beef with Cornel West running for president right now, he ain't nothing but Bernie Sanders in blackface. Because what's the difference in him and Bernie? Bernie was making all the arguments that Cornell was making. In fact, Cornell endorsed Bernie after Bill Bradley. He endorsed Bernie. So what is Cornell doing if he ain't running on reparations? As a Black man, when he sees Black people all over America mobilized around reparations, he's running about Palestine and Israel. And my beef with Cornell West is, if you ain't running on reparations, but your hometown, he always talking about he's from Sacramento, his mama, the Baptist church he's from there. But his city has a reparations committee, and he ain't talking about reparations, but he running for president. And his city and the capital both have reparations proposals. And Cornell ain't even talking reparations nowhere.
Well, Dr. Taylor, I want you to let me say this. He was just on with us before we was on the air because he thought that he was due today. So he called in, but I told him that, we had a little mix-up and that you were going to be on.
He might hear this, and he might need to call me because
I'm not on it. He asked, he said, you got my friend coming on tonight. I said, yeah, he'll be on with us. So
I didn't know. That's the first time I ever heard that Cornel West knew who I was. Maybe I need to be nicer.
Well, he'll be on with us on the 24th. So
that's cool.
My point is, I really
think Cornel West should be running on reparations and nothing else. That should be his only conversation. And the fact that it's the one thing he's not talking about. Okay, let's say he talks about Israel-Palestine. Let's say he talks about the 99%. Let's say he talks about war and all the great things that Cornel West stands for. Why is he not talking reparations too then? So this is a betrayal. It's not neutral. It's you going out of your way. Please hear me, people. Obama got away with never discussing reparations when it was at a high point when Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote the article in 2014. Obama was president, and Obama never had to say something about Ta-Nehisi Coates' article, which got him the MacArthur Genius Award and that in his book, and a National Book Award. Somehow Obama and Michelle got away with never talking about reparations. So did Kamala. And when Kamala talked about it, she said, I ain't giving you nothing. We've heard it. We've seen that clip. And my point is, Biden right now is doing what Obama taught him. Don't acknowledge reparations. So black folk are mobilizing around reparations, and they're watching billions and billions being given to the Ukrainians who are racist, fascists. I told my students, I hope both sides lose in Russia and Ukraine. I hope they both lose. They ain't got nothing to do with us as a people, except to see how easy it is to give $300 billion to a group of people when they want to.
Yep.
And it just shows us the disrespect for who we are as a people, even in the 21st century, even after the first black president, and all of the celebrity, you know, profiles we can point to. They still are showing us through this passive-aggressive response to reparations that they don't respect us. And it's the Democrats. The Democrats are doing it. That's why Biden is having trouble with black folk. It's like he's out of touch. We talking reparations. He's talking Ukraine and immigrants in Chicago, where black folk are mobilized around reparations, and they keep watching hundreds of millions of dollars and Social Security cards and, you know, debit cards and things of that sort being given to the immigrant groups. And they're also listening and saying, oh, we shouldn't allow them to pit us against each other. You know what? Black folk have had to listen to that kind of talk forever, and we always end up on the short end of that stick. And I'm glad the black folk in Chicago are saying, hell no, because too often we defer to our coalition partners and we end up junior partners in our coalition relationships. And so for that reason, you know, I have nothing against immigrants. I know what precipitates their coming, the circumstances, the conditions, the American policies in those areas. But when it comes down to the fact that black folk are organized around reparations because of harm that Chicago has done around housing, the Daily Machine, the Chicago Police Department, you know, that's, you know, that's something that people really are passionate about. And the idea that they can watch money just coming right past them while they're in line arguing and marching is why Biden, that and him hugging Netanyahu after October 7th, is why Biden's having a hard time despite an impressive, you know, presidential domestic policy. Like can't nobody touch Biden in domestic policy. Not FDR, not even LBJ. Biden has put more money into the domestic, infrastructure and job development and training, education, than any president in American history. Biden's number one. But when black folks see what's happening in these places where they're organizing around reparations and they see that they elected this man and his administration and get no acknowledgement of I told somebody recently, whoever says reparations first between Trump and Biden is going to win. And Trump already sounded foolish last night talking about black folk, only black people he can see, you know, the people he can see in the room is the black folk. Of course, that's going to hurt him. It's not that much worse than Biden saying, if you don't vote for me, you ain't black. It's about the same kind of stupidity of two old white racists, and they both are old white racists. Biden wins because he's racist enough for the conservative voter to vote for him instead of Trump. And that's how he beat him in 2020. If Biden was racist enough, all you got to do is look at his 1970s, 80s speeches, and you hear a militant racist from Delaware. He wasn't on the 1984 crime bill. Biden wasn't indifferent. He wasn't passive. He was a revolutionary about it. You know, he said brutal things about immigration being a racial jungle. You know, Obama is clean and articulate. You know, all that kind of stuff. You know, there's plenty of black folk that know Biden's record. But that's why he keeps winning. That's why he can beat Trump, because he got enough racism in his own background to take some of that vote away from Trump. But when it comes back to reparations, like I said, whichever one of them were to say reparations first, I think it would stimulate black enthusiasm. And among the other things that we've inspired from San Francisco, for example, the California Committee that's based in Sacramento, where Reverend Brown is on both committees, they said $300,000 per person. And then our committee in San Francisco, we came out and said $5 million. And our website had gotten, I think, 1,300 hits for 2 years. On January 15, Martin Luther King's birthday, 2022, the article hit from the Chronicle, and we got 13,000 hits in 1 day. And that got everybody's attention when we said $5 million. The message to me, I would die proud that we did that, because it said to everybody, this was no small matter. This ain't no $50,000 remedy. You can't fix this with $180,000. This was generational harm in San Francisco is millions of dollars. San Francisco has more billionaires than anywhere in America outside of New York City, and more millionaires outside of America, inside of America, other than New York City. And the money and that millions and billions was created by San Francisco favoring white people over everybody else, including the Chinese, who they excluded, the Japanese, who they interned, and Native Americans, who they genocided. But when it came to us, you know, California did not enslave black people. It had racial discrimination, including the war on drugs. And that's where I come in. I've insisted a lot on the committee that we emphasize the war on drugs harm is as much a part of reparations as you would argue for slavery or Jim Crow harm. We have got to bring it up to date, because most of us, brother, like you, Elliot, you were affected by this. You survived the drug war. Your family members got caught up in it. Mm-hmm. You know your whole neighborhood, where you come from, who got messed up and who didn't. What repair is there for you? What repair is there for your family? Have our drama with each other as black folk is because we had these problems. And now look at how they're treating Sentinel. It's a public health crisis. It's not a war. Because who are the addicts of Sentinel? It ain't us. Google the phrase "death of despair," and you will see a bunch of articles explaining how white people in their 40s through 60s are depressed, miserable. Ronald Reagan took $55 trillion from them. Trillion. $55 trillion is what Reagan took with trickle-down economics from the average American. The black, Asian, Latino, gay, straight American, middle class. You know, your grandfather, my grandfather, may have been able to afford a house to leave it for the family and hopefully, you know, keep it in the family for two or three generations. In San Francisco, they had redevelopment with a guy named Justin Herman. And in New York, his name was Robert Moses. In L.A., they had a different developer. This happened in Chicago, in Detroit, in every city in America. You know, urban planners came in and they just raised, I'm saying R-A-Z-E-D, they raised the black communities all over America. Now, this is the good thing about Biden and Pete Buttigieg. They're literally going back and looking at all the racist infrastructure in America, and they are tearing it down. That's what Buttigieg is doing. In Buffalo, there's a racist bridge. In Gary, Indiana, some racist cemented an overpass that stood for five decades. Somebody just cemented it to keep black Gary from going over into the nearby white town And Buttigieg is tearing that down. Everywhere you see a freeway or an expressway, practically, the Ryan in Chicago, the 105 in L.A., Geary Boulevard in San Francisco, most of what Robert Moses did in New York was all aimed at destroying black middle class affluence and wealth. If they had just left us alone, Du Bois said in Black Reconstruction, we just needed more time for Reconstruction. Instead of 12, 13 years, we needed about 70 years of Reconstruction. Instead, America responded with 70 years of Jim Crow. And that's why we still are dealing with racial issues, because you were born, I was born, your mama was born, my mama was born, and they passed on what they went through to us. And we went through it too. You, me, I think my good brother Errol Henderson is listening, a great professor at Penn State University, he went through it. We survived the war on drugs, brother. Where's our reparations? Think about this, Brother Elliot. Just on the fines, F-I-N-E-S, the fines alone on black folk during the war on drugs would be in the billions for everybody that went to jail that we know. They got time, but they also got financial punishment. And they said you got 5 years and $50,000 that you got to pay back. Imagine how much money, brothers, the state got from us through the fines during the war on drugs. And I've never heard anybody else I know on earth talk about that issue.
Dr. Taylor,
have you?
No.
Have you?
No.
Think about that, brother. Think about all the relatives you have had, if any, that went through the system and the fines they financially got, and whether or not your family ever got out of the financial hole they were in. I got brothers, without telling their business, who have felonies. And they're still in debt, permanently. And we never think about that. But that's part of the war on drugs. That's why the war on drugs has to be a part of any conversation of reparations.
Dr. Taylor, I want to transition into to politics. But before we do that, let me ask this question in reference to the 14 measure that was put forth by the legislative caucus, supposedly dealing with the issue of reparations, but no financial or no money was attached. Was there any conversation between some of the groups that was doing the work, like San Francisco, Sacramento, the other groups?
Yes.
Was it any conversation about, hey, listen, we're going to put this bill forth, we're going to do this, or they just did this, and, you men and women were surprised. How did that work? How did that go?
I think we had outstanding people on the California level committee, and we had outstanding people on the San Francisco level committee. And I think both committees have created permanently models for how to proceed, how to do the research, how to gather the data related to the injuries. What are the injuries? Defining the injuries, defining who should be eligible. We did that without a whole lot of complication. What hurt us is the Democrats. What hurt us is London Breed. London Breed is a black girl from the projects in San Francisco, from Fillmore. Her project is called Plaza East. Her grandmother, who raised her, and her brother and sister, her brother's in prison for killing his girlfriend, and the sister, her sister OD, in Potrero Hill. So London has felt the full pain of being black in San Francisco. And again, what we organize around is the injury that happened to London Breed's people and to all of those from the 1940s, because black folk got here significantly in California in San Francisco in 1943, not 1843. We didn't get here until the 40s. That's what's so amazing to me about Black Power and the Panthers is it happens in 1966. Y'all just got here, whereas New York, Philly, Boston, black folk have been organized since the 1700s, with Prince Hall, and Richard Allen, Absalom Jones. That go back to the 1700s. The Bay Area, the black leadership really, Asa Philip Randolph was here with the Brothers of Jim Crow Porters. They were here. in the '40s, and that was the inspiration for much of what becomes Black Power. But people don't really make that connection to from the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, because most of the black men in West Oakland worked there. And Huey's father, Bobby Seale's father, you know, all of those men worked in San Francisco under C.L. Dellums and Asa Philip Randolph. And that, more than OPD's abuse, explains the emergence of the Black Panther Party, is that these young men watched their fathers stand up. Huey Newton, I'm writing here right now while we're talking. That's why I'm a little bit late. I got caught up in writing. But I'm writing about revolutionary suicide right now. And, you know, Jim Jones used that. And, you know, I've been working on that book forever on Jim Jones. Jim Jones used that concept as he killed about 800 black people and 100 others. But, you know, he bases revolutionary suicide largely on his father's courage as a black man in Monroe, Louisiana, who would not take anything from any white man. So Jim Jones tried to romanticize it and make revolutionary suicide sexy and, you know, deep and interesting and, oh, this is what we did. But Huey's understanding of revolutionary suicide was deeply connected to his father and his father's courage and the courage of those. If you Google, there's a movie called 1,000 Men, and it's called 10,000 Men Called George.
Yeah.
That's the movie. That's the real roots of the Black Panther Party and the Black Power Movement, the Black Liberation Army, a lot of the organizations that, you know, emerge here. There's always been a deep connection. Reparations emerging in the Bay Area, you can't separate it from Colin Kaepernick out here or from even Black Lives Matter, even though I have a deep, deep, deep problem with the women and people that led that movement and how they distracted it, made it about gender and sexuality primarily, when none of the people we were organizing around were, you know, victims around their sexuality, apart from being a black man, like, you know, Ahmaud Arbery or Tamir Rice or Trayvon Martin or Mike Brown, and then it became about something else. You know, and I don't even want to get into that. The Los Angeles Black Panther, the Los Angeles Black Lives Matter movement is led by a sister I went to college with. I'm older than her. Malina Abdullah is my sister. She will always be my sister. And I support her 100%. And she's had, she's been arrested. She's had LAPD threaten her, threaten her children. And she stood on her ground, but she does not support, you know, Black Lives Matter that started in Oakland. But the point is, when it was initiated, as far as I remember, they were up here. You know, they weren't down in L.A., and they really came out of the Oscar Grant movement, which was on the ground from January 2009 going forward. And then Black Lives Matter happens 2013, I think, as a result of the Trayvon Martin, imagine 2014, Trayvon Martin verdict. They came 5 years after, and that organization that they belonged to was a Marxist and lesbian, gay, LGBTQ organization. And the media made them the whole story. The same thing happened, you know, with Me Too. Me Too was a black woman, Tyrande Burke, saying to white women, yo, y'all forgetting us with the pink hats. Y'all forgetting us sisters. Me Too. And all of a sudden, what did the media do? The media turned the whole movement into what? Me Too. They turned the whole movement into BLM. But the real movement in Oakland and in the Bay Area was Black Lives was the Oscar Grant movement. And what blows my mind about that is we all saw a major motion picture film, right? A Hollywood film with, you know, Michael B. Jordan and Ryan Coogler making it, and that was the main thing here. And that's where Black Lives Matter came out of. But they turned it to a different emphasis. And I'm not sitting here to bash on gay people, but I'm saying the emphasis of the movement changed.
Mm-hmm.
Reparations, it came out of the George Floyd moment. But I think Bernie Sanders' campaigns articulated well the whole problem of disparities between the haves and the have-nots. In general, going back to Ronald Reagan taking that $55 trillion from them. And when Bernie was talking about the 99% and the 1% and the Occupy happened, that's where reparations is gaining more momentum. Because if you remember around that time, Brother Elliott, that's when they were telling us about all this data that showed the disparities between black household income, black personal wealth, how much money a black person, has in their pocket compared to the average white person, how much a white family has compared to the average black, family per capita. All this data, all this rich data show these wide disparities. And that's what I've tried to say. Reparations is really ain't nothing but being white in America. And you ain't never heard that before either. But that's what reparations is. It ain't nothing but being what the government does for white folk. FDIC, we got your back. And what we asked the state to do, and again, we got the problem of 209 here. We got the problem of affirmative action being banished here. It got rejected again in 2020. It got eliminated in 96, but it got rejected again in 2020. And the Chinese community was the main funders of the defeat of affirmative action. And we can talk about that separate, because the Chinese community got some real problems with black folk that we don't have with them. You saw that in Harvard. You saw that in North Carolina. And they were the number one funders of the defeat of affirmative action in the state of California in terms of trying to bring it back in 2020. Who opposed it? The Chinese community opposed it. And London Breed right now opposed reparations. We came up with a $10 million committee recommendation. We wanted to institutionalize reparations in San Francisco. And we tried to create an Office of Reparations at $10 million, and she rejected it. Then we reduced it to $2 million, and she tabled it. And then about 10 days ago or 2 weeks ago, she line-itemed it out and said, as a part of the budgetary process, she eliminated affirmative action. Reparations, the idea of a reparations committee. Because the way government works is if you can get your issue or your policy brought in to the apparatus, the bureaucracy, it's pretty much going to live. And you just have to keep getting friendly sponsors to fund it. So we're in good shape in California. What we got in San Francisco, in both Sacramento at the state level and in the city level, is our foot in the door, brothers and sisters. We've got our foot in the door, not like we wanted. We wanted to knock the door down and say, give us our 40 acres and a mule. But we haven't done that. What we did do is we got our foot in the door, and it's open, and now it's up to, I think, everybody, young, black, white, Asian, every group, but especially black folk, have to mobilize around reparations. The work ain't done. We did the work to make the case. We made the case, and that's the beauty about what we did in San Francisco, what they did in California. What they did with Darity and Mullen, a married couple down at Duke, they wrote a book called From Here to Equality, and they don't agree with us with what our approach is, because they want to do a top-down approach. They feel like the federal government is the only entity that can really do reparations properly. And I agree with that. But just like gay marriage and marijuana, where they come from, the Bay Area, in terms of mobilizing it as a political idea that eventually got support from even the government, right? So gay marriage and marijuana legalization are almost models for what we try to do with reparations here. But Darity, D-A-R-I-T-Y, and Mullins, M-U-L-L-I-N-S, they're a married couple at Duke, outstanding economists. Mm-hmm. But she explains that there's only $5 trillion across America at the county and city level. And so that would not be sufficient, because they propose about $14 to $19 trillion, and they think it has to come from the federal government. And again, when we're watching all this money being thrown around the world for war, it's hard to tell black folk that that's not possible. But London Breed, going back to her, had this other program running parallel with reparations the whole time called the Dream Keepers Initiative. And my student runs the Dream Keepers Initiative. I got a bunch of students in City Hall in San Francisco, a bunch. And the Dream Keepers Initiative is like a $50 million funding program for all kinds of like jobs, contracts, mentoring program. It's an outstanding program, and it will continue to be funded on and on, as long as London Breed's in power. So that was reparations for her. She, you know, she's doing reparations without calling it reparations. And maybe that's the trick we got to use on them. Maybe we should stop calling it reparations and let Biden and Buttigieg do the bridges. For example, I got pulled in about a week ago by these white folk who came to San Francisco after our efforts. This is what I mean. We influence things beyond, can I show you line item what we got out of our reparations efforts? I can show you those, but I can tell you there are things that are happening because of our efforts that we cannot measure. Again, in Bayview Huntersport is the hood in San Francisco. And there's a video, a movie out called Straight Out of Bayview, or Straight Out of Huntersport. So Huntersport is the hood in San Francisco. I had a group of people approach me last week who have $200 million. I ain't never talked to nobody who got $200 million before, Brother Elliot. But these people approached me. They got $200 million that they're going to invest in Black Bayview Huntersport and refurbish an entire area with all of this greenery and environment for the health of the people. Parks, walking parks, dog parks, tennis courts, basketball courts. And they're in, and this, again, this is reparations without the name. And I think we inspired it. Why did it? Otherwise, why the hell are they contacting James Taylor, who's on the reparations committee? Do you think that's a coincidence? They asked me to do this. And we submitted our proposal to the city. And they've given us four areas that they're going to concede. And like you said, the California Black Legislative Caucus has mentioned 14. No, it does not include cash stimulus. But that's what I mean by getting your foot in the door. If you know how government bureaucracy works, get your foot in the door. Then we can get that money. We can get the cash. The stimulus can come if we can get a reparations office. Brother, that's what I'm saying. We got our foot in the door. We didn't knock it down like we wanted to, but we got our foot in the door in these specific ways because California is not saying no. California is saying this is what we can do. San Francisco did not say no. San Francisco's outlined four areas they're going to try to respond to immediately, including cash. Including cash, Elliot. For the elders. Cash for the elders is part of what they're doing. And 3 days ago here in San Francisco, look it up online, please. The city council is organizing a meeting to decide how to do an apology for all of the racial abuse of Black people throughout the city's history. Now, to me, Elliot, if I die in the next 5 minutes, brother, how do you think I feel as a Black man? I know it ain't perfect. I know we want money behind it. I know apologies ain't enough. We've had that from the Senate. We've had apologies, and it don't mean a damn thing without money. I think Juneteenth being recognized by Joe Biden without reparations is an insult. It's like letting us free with abolition without 40 acres and a mule. So I had a problem not with Biden recognizing Juneteenth, but not funding it. White people love Martin Luther King's dream. Fund Martin Luther King's dream. Because he got up there and he said, we have come here to cast a check, and it's been marked insufficient funds. That's what Martin Luther King said, and I have a dream. But most white people, most liberals, all they hear is, my four children will not be judged by the color of their skin, but the content of their character. They don't hear him saying, we came here to cast a check and bounce on Black people, and it's been marked insufficient funds. And Martin King is to... You can find Martin King on YouTube multiple times in different ways, brilliantly breaking down reparations, talking about land grants and how the European peasantry was aided by our in total, you know, federal system, the Homestead Act, how FDR's New Deal was, you know, administered by the Jim Crow state, and we didn't benefit from it. That's why I respect Buttigieg, and that's why I respect Biden, because they literally have looked at the data, and they've seen the history of federal policies on Black folk in terms of housing and infrastructure and development. And the tragedy is, you know, the United States government did not try to develop us. It went out of its way to use Rodney Walter Rodney's term, they underdeveloped us. And that's part of our problem right now in America, is that white America, that the United States of America underdeveloped black folk intentionally through policy, and it overdeveloped white folk. And now who's having crisis? Us? No. We're not in crisis. We're in our normal state, but white folk are the ones suffering the fentanyl crisis. They are suffering deaths of despair. They're not a parallel phenomena amongst black people who are 40, 50, and 60 happening. It's only happening with white people, nobody else. And their numbers are in deep decline. And I told my students 2 days ago, I imagine in about 200 years, we're going to see the un-Christopher Columbus or the anti-Christopher Columbus, meaning the last white man to leave America might happen in the next 200 years because their numbers are going down in drastic ways. And Harold Kuss, who's my favorite thinker, actually projected that this might happen one day, that white people might leave America and go back to Europe or Canada, and that's going to happen. The data, look at the data. This is not off the top of my head. This is off the United States Census for 2055, 2065, 2075. Black people right now are 45 million, about to hit 75 million in 30 years, not 100 years. Black people about to be 75 million. And our numbers don't increase, our percentage doesn't increase because every other group increases. But guess which group does not increase? The only group not growing in America and the only group dying out in America is white people in America. Asians are doubling from 3% to 6%. Latinos, their birth rates are superseding Anglo birth rates in every county in America, including places like Vermont, New Hampshire, South Dakota, North Dakota. Latinos are outperforming white women in North Dakota. And when you saw the racists out there at Charlottesville, when they were talking about the Jews will not replace us, when I saw that, Brother Elliot, I said, they need to go home and have sex. Go home and make babies, man, because that's the only way y'all going to solve your problem is y'all need more babies, because y'all believed in all of the, 2.5 kid bull crap that nobody else in America believed in. And the Asians didn't believe in it. Latinos didn't believe in it. Indians didn't believe in it. Black Americans didn't believe in it. The 2.5 thing is why you disappeared. They ain't got no kids to replace them. I'm just telling you, brother. There's an article by David Brooks, who is a conservative Reaganite, in the Atlantic, called the Nuclear Family, How We Had It Wrong All Along. And it shows a black girl on the cover with her daddy and her mama opening up a church house. And it goes on to talk about how abnormal the idea was of the nuclear family in Western history, and how black, Asian, Latino family structures, or even white Catholic, like the Irish, white Catholics, like the Italians, white Catholics, they had multiple babies because of their opposition to birth control. They had a lot of babies. And how this model is a better model to judge family structure than the idea of the nuclear model that white people perpetrated. And guess what? That explains in part why they are disappearing in this country, because they sold us Father Knows Best, Ozzy and Harriet, Leave It to Beaver, a few of them. I know you know some of those songs, Brother Elliot. we had another trade but to watch that stuff.
Well, Go ahead,
Richard.
Yeah, Dr. Taylor, I'm taking in, as it relates to reparations, all that you're saying in relationship to the benefit that has come out of the San Francisco and California initiative in relationship to that. The first question, and I think I have a couple of abstract questions, and I apologize because you're speaking operational things from a political perspective. Would you consider black people in general, and well, to be more specific, is black people in California, would you consider still, or would you consider them as a colonized people within the state at political and economic apparatus?
Brother, I love that question. But I think it needs to be broadened to the whole idea of Black America. In the same way, Jamaican.
I was trying to go there, but I was talking.
I've been saying to my students that part of our dilemma is we have a colonial problem that we keep thinking is racial.
Right.
But much of our condition, Franz Fanon talked about this idea, but you know, more importantly, to someone like Cedric Robinson's work, In Terms of Order, or his book Black Marxism. They talk about the idea of colonialism before it was applied to Black folk, just on the Irish alone for 700 years in England, and then how they cut and pasted that and transposed it onto Black folk. I would argue, you know, that when you sort of think about, you know, the sort of, you know, patterns of these issues of racial oppression as it impacts, you know, Black folk, I think we're colonized. We can see it with the Dominicans. We can see it with the Puerto Ricans, the Guamanians, the Samoans. Right, in those so-called territories, we see them as colonies. We can see Blacks in Brazil, right? Dominican Republic, I already said. But, you know, Haiti. Ain't no confusion that Black folk ain't from Haiti. Black folk ain't from Haiti. There may have been some, you know, Tiano or, you know, Arawak or Carib people early, where we get the word Caribbean from. You know, those are the people that Columbus actually came into contact with, were the Caribbeans, the Carib, in the Bahamas, not the United States. But yes, brother, there was a whole intelligence that emerges out of the Black Power movement that developed around, I think, in part from James and Grace Lee Boggs in Detroit, but also in part between Harold Cruz, C-R-U-S-E, who wrote The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual, he talks about the, you know, our internal colonial predicament. And when Martin Luther King said, I have a dream, that's the wrong conversation. We don't need you to dream. We need you to unpack colonialism. See, that's what Martin Luther King needed to do at I Have a Dream, would not express this desire for middle classdom, because that's all he did. He needed to explain that the Black predicament was uniquely an internal colonial situation. There's a research paper that's been written recently about the ongoing relevance of internal colonialism. I'm sure you can find it if you go on the Google Scholar and look for internal colonialism and its ongoing relevance.
Go ahead, Richard.
I'm trying to move towards, you know, the operational, as you were laying out, you know, political benefit from the, as you say, this reparation moment. And I'm the next question I have is a concern. And it is, you know, from another abstract. My concern is from the Black ideological tradition. How is this reparation, being presented? Is that something I should even project or impose on as these reparation efforts are being taken place, whether locally or state or nationally, that we do have a political ideological tradition and one.
Oh, absolutely, brother. You know, it goes back. And this is what I think average Black people don't appreciate. That we did not advocate for integration. That came in 1909 with the white-led NAACP, not the National Association of Colored People, but the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. These are white Jews who were Marxists and socialists, and The only black people involved in the founding was Du Bois, and they gave him the journal, The Crisis, and Ida B. Wells was there, and she wasn't even important in the room at all. She was just there. And so, you know, when you talk about the black ideological tradition, Harold Cruz sees that as a sort of tug and pendulum move back and forth between, you know, Garvey and, say, Du Bois or Booker and Du Bois, or let's say Garvey and, Asa Philip Randolph, or let's say Asa Philip Randolph versus Du Bois, or, you know, when, you know, Fannie Lou Hamer and Ella Baker come along, they have their whole nother strategy and focus aiming at the Democratic Party in Mississippi, right? You know, I think part of our tug, the thing that I think is advanced reparations, is that you have someone like Randall Robinson write the book The Debt, What America Owes to Black People. He is a, you know, with his brother Max Robinson from back in the day. We remember him, he had the plane crash. Max Robinson's brother, Randall, he was a mainstream liberal integrationist, you know, civil writer. And when he wrote that book, it got all of our attention. And then he wrote the book after that called Quitting America, because he was frustrated with the lack of response from his first book. And then when Coates wrote that article, Coates modernized the whole conversation. That's what I think we need to understand. Why are we talking about reparations in 2024? Because Ta-Nehisi Coates' article modernized the debate. He updated it. And he's not the only one to do it. In COBRA, the Republic of New Africa that Tupac and Afeni Shakur and Asata Shakur and Matulu Shakur all belong to, a fellow black political scientist who was a disciple of Malcolm X's from Detroit, Imari Obadeli. Imari Obadeli was a lawyer and his brother. The two of them were Malcolm's, you know, most committed disciples. And they created the Republic of New Africa, I want to say. Yeah, the Republic of New Africa. You know, no, I'm sorry, Incobra. Incobra.
Both of them.
They put Incobra. I'm sorry, I made a mistake.
Both of them.
Oh, okay. Well, good. I have to talk to my brother Errol Henderson. He has to straighten me out on that. But my point is, you know, Imari Obadeli was a black political scientist like me. Mm. You know, and he was a lawyer. And I had the good experience one time of being on the panel with him. And I'm thankful that I had that experience with him. But he was very sincerely committed to the idea that black folks should have five states in the southern states, like Mormons have Utah. So nobody complained about the Mormons having Utah. How come we can't have Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, and about actually all 11 Confederate states? We need more than five, because we work all of them. And the key period that a book called The Other Half Has Been Untold explains is from the Civil War. I'm sorry, from the American Revolution to the Civil War. That 90-year period of time right there is where black labor, free, oppressed, chained, gave America the push it needed past the Western powers, you know, and past their mercantilism stage. So that's when we say we are the ones that are the basis of this economy built this country. We need to be more specific between the American Revolution and the Civil War, and 100 years before the American Revolution, and 150 years after the Civil War, we continue to build this country.
I'm really, I use the term concern, and I appreciate your feedback, because if we look over our long view of our black political tradition, a somewhat separate but inclusive, separate as a people because of the way we came here, right? We formulated development, our political formations were recognizing our separateness, even though our aspiration was to be included within the American project, spite of its white race-based
beginnings. And so when I'm, you know, the next question I wanted to get your feedback on, because we do hear, even as we look at all these different reparations efforts, and we hear the proposals based off of the research that comes out in relationship to the harm, what I'm asking is, how do we make the distinction but between what we're entitled to as citizens of America and what we should be demanding through the political process, or demanding from ourselves first as a part of the reparations, you know, moment, you know, because a lot of these things are sounding like things that we should be entitled to as citizens, and money is being put in, you know, different boxes, political boxes. But those things are what we should have been getting as citizens.
House, right.
Education.
Right. No,
get these special things like their reparation package. And so I'm confused. I'm asking, you know, can you help me teeter out? How do we make that distinction? As we
I think the confusion is based in the confusion of the whole situation. When you think about, you know, the way, you know, reparations is being talked about, and when you ask, what should we do? I think now that the work has been done at the committee level, is people have to mobilize politically. Like London Breed, this is what I told the people in San Francisco. London Breed should not be able to be at any public event as she's running for re-election without somebody asking her about reparations. They have to, you know, that should happen to Biden. How come ain't nobody asking about reparations? We got black journalists all on TV. We feeling good about them being online. On TV, how come nobody's asking Biden the reparations question? It's like an agreement that we're not going to approach it.
Exactly.
As if we're not serious at every level. And that's the thing that Democrats have to understand. The people involved in reparations are the most mobilized, the most active, the most politically conscious black people in every city. So what the hell do you think they're going to do when you come around in November asking for a vote? They're going to demobilize their people. You think I'm going to run out? You think after all we did, I'm going to run out and vote for goddamn Joe Biden?
And the statistics are showing that, in the sense of people not already, they're concerned. The parties are concerned. Well,
it's because of the disrespect. It's because they're disrespectful. This is disrespectful. Even if Biden had to make a statement that we can't do reparations, although that's ridiculous, don't ignore it. Especially when you see your constituents mobilized around it in Georgia, in North Carolina. The Pope went to Canada recently and renounced the original doctrine of discovery. 700 years, no Pope would do it. I think we in San Francisco inspired the Pope to denounce the doctrine of discovery in Canada, and he had gone there earlier and apologized for what they did to the indigenous people. I think you can't even begin to touch, brother, what we've impacted and the spiritual. It's up to the young people to take it to the next level. My ass is almost 60 years old now. I've been fighting all my life.
Mm-hmm.
I need somebody else to fight. We're doing the work. We're laying down the foundation. We've documented the injury. There's no argument that can stand against reparations anymore. There's not a single argument that a devil can offer in an intelligent, objective room of people that can account for why we don't get reparations. When we see Indians in California, there's about 56 tribes that don't pay taxes. And don't nobody know it. 76 Indian tribes can't get recognized as Indian tribes. They're trying. So they can get that Indian gaming, which is reparations, and they also don't pay. There's about 56 federally recognized tribes in California that do not pay state taxes. That's reparations. And it's been going on. Right now, brother, Google it. They're looking for 400 women who they what do you call it when you mess up their reproductive health?
Mm-hmm.
I'm having a brain freeze for a second, but they basically, you know, had this hysterectomies
mm-hmm.
on 400 women in California who did not know. So California is now looking for 400 women to give them reparations.
And finally, I just want to say my concern again, you know, and I appreciate that your response to that is, you know, and it keeps coming to my mind based off of the questions I've asked, you know, so far, as we are, and I don't deny that we are in this reparation moment, and I don't deny that the, you know, the population, the general, you know, population demographics, they're changing in America. What I'm concerned with, even with these efforts, is that we'll have an American version of what Frederick Lugar did in Nigeria about indirect rule. I mean, totally. So that we can have, at various levels, Black people in these various positions, from the local to the national. But the condition of us is still as a colonized and systemically. And right. That's what I'm concerned with.
I'm with you.
As I go through this, as we go well, through.
I love the fact that you have this consciousness. You know, a lot of people don't think of Black America as anything other than integrated Americans.
You're right.
This comes from E. Franklin Frazier, you know, the Black bourgeoisie, and other, you know, Black intellectuals, you know, that just said, we're American. Even Gunnar Myrdal in 1944, his book, American Dilemma, is like, you know, we're Americans, you know, even though the brother who wrote Invisible Man came back and said, you know, why do Black people have to die on the hills of the white man's dilemma? You know, we have to deal with these realities. But I think the part of our confusion as a Black people in America is we don't understand our colonial circumstances. We were colonized by a people who were colonized. Think about that.
Mm.
Name another group like that. In world history, there might be some out there, like in Scotland or something like that. You know, the Welsh, I don't know their history in detail. But Black America was colonized by white America that was colonized by King George III in England.
Mm-hmm.
And we fought on the side of King George III in England, 5,000 of us versus 500 of us that fought on the side of the American colonies. We were trying to get freedom because of Sierra Leone and what the British had done for them. So the British told us, and we thought we were free in 1812, for the War of 1812, we thought we got free then. Black people thought abolition happened in 1812, with the War of 1812, because we fought on their side. Then we did it again in the America. We did it first in the American Revolution. And the promise was if we fought on their side, we would get abolition. So Black folks were like, we're fighting for our freedom. Unfortunately for us and the Indians, we fought on the losing side, and we got stuck behind enemy lines. But we are a colonized people. So nothing Martin Luther King prescribed, nothing Malcolm X prescribed. I would say only Howard Cruz and probably James Lee Boggs and Grace Lee Boggs truly theorized, and there's an outstanding book by my friend I've mentioned twice today, Errol Henderson. He's an outstanding professor who stood on his ground, if you look at his record, at Penn State University. But he's recently written a book called The Revolution Will Not Be Theorized.
Right.
And he takes up the, you know, theoretical misunderstandings and misreadings of the Black power, you know, Black power generation as it related to the slave revolution that was the American Civil War. In other words, he argues, like Du Bois does in Black Reconstruction, that the American Civil War was a Black revolution within a civil war between whites. The whites were fighting the Civil War. 175,000 Black men took up guns. Brother, we saw Glory, the movie Glory, That was a real movie. That was a real account of the real 54th Infantry in Massachusetts. And when 175,000 men, black, took up guns and killed white men with impunity, think about that, Brother Elliot. If we got 175,000 Crips and Bloods and gangster disciples and L looking together right now, what the hell would that be? All united behind one cause, guns loaded. Would that not be the American Revolution? Of all revolutions. And Du Bois and Henderson argue that what most black people and white people don't understand is that the Civil War was a black revolution. That's what glory is about, a black revolution. Remember how angry Denzel was and how militant Denzel was. It was a black revolution within a white civil war over, you know, the direction of the country. And so, again, I think we should be inspired with reparations. We've gotten it further than it's ever been. It's more widely accepted. It's more mainstream. And that could be negative and positive, and we can figure it out over time. But I do know this. UC Berkeley published an article, and the way it was run out here in California was the majority of Californians opposed cash payments to black America, black Californians for reparations. But Brother Elliot, if you go back and look at some of the early data around reparations and public opinions around it in, say, 1977, 1987, 1997, 2007, 2017, you will not find a lot of support for it. We got what the UC Berkeley article and survey should have said was, support for reparations and cash payments in California is at an all-time high of 41%. 41%, Brother Elliot, is what California is saying about cash. Tell me, brother, if that's not high. That's including white, Asians, all our haters. All our haters are in there. And it's still 41%. Hell, if it's 10 people in the room, oh, that's 4 out of 10. All you got to do is put one more person over to your side, and it's 50-50. So to me, what we've done is we've laid the groundwork, or we built on, going back to the earlier question about the sort of, you know, history, you know, we built on the work of Charlie House. There's an outstanding book by Mary Frances Day, who was in the Clinton administration in the Civil Rights Division. She wrote a book called My Skin is Black is True, The Story of Charlie House. And every black child, every black adult, to know who this sister is. She had a following that she joined. She didn't lead them. She joined them and then became their leader. She and a man named Isaiah Washington or Dickerson together, he was a pastor, they joined a movement in Memphis that was in place in the 1880s and 90s with 200,000 black people. Did you hear me? 200,000 black people in Memphis supported reparations in a movement that Charlie House joined and became the leader of inadvertently. They even used the mail frauds against Charlie House in the 1890s. They made her do a year in jail, and they took down Reverend Isaiah too, against Marcus Garvey. Brother Elliot, I'm trying to say to you that the mail fraud charges against Garvey were first used against Charlie House.
Mm-hmm.
30 years earlier. Look it up, brother. This is some... You know who I am. Look it up. They use it against her first, and then they use it against Garvey. 30 years later. And Charlie House is a black woman black people should know like they know Sojourner Truth. I think more so than Sojourner Truth, but certainly Harriet Tubman too. We should have Charlie House on the tip of our tongues when we're talking about reparations. If you don't know who Charlie House is, don't say a damn thing to me about reparations. Because we can't even have a conversation because you're not even in the realm of understanding that black people did not want reparation. They did not want integration. Like I said, with the NAACP, that was 1909. In the 1890s, they were only organizing around one thing: reparations. Black America was organizing on reparations, not integration. That comes with the NAACP. And I'm not saying there weren't black folks that wanted, that didn't run into the mainstream, but I'm talking about organized political, you know, movements and organizations. Charlie House sued the United States Treasury for about, I think it was about $63 million for 7 years as a slave. And her logic was that because the United States used, and this is what I'm saying, we don't even know our ancestors who we can build on. We should be building on Cowley House. Look at what she and the people of Memphis did. She sued. But the logic was, when you look at the cotton and how the cotton was raised by the Confederacy, the cotton that the Confederacy had in its possession was confiscated and taxed to be about $60-something million. And Cowley House said, we picked that cotton. Now think about that, brothers. We picked that cotton because the United States government was going to use it to give it to the Union troops as a veterans, you know, a veterans benefit. And she said, those soldiers didn't pick the cotton. We picked the cotton. Give it to us. And for her efforts, the United States government at the federal level, the United States Postal Office came down on her. They arrested her and they destroyed her. And she was never fully the same after that. Mm-hmm. And Reverend Isaiah Dickerson, I believe his name was, mm-hmm. Reverend Isaiah Dickerson, too. So they destroyed the federal government. And there was actually a federal case that went to the Supreme Court. It's called the McAdoo case. And the McAdoo case, the Supreme Court said that the United States government is immune to what it did in slavery. And that's what we never really understood in our reparations efforts. In COBRA, Republic of New Africa, all of these efforts, I don't know if they understood that the precedent that the Supreme Court has is the United States government, like a cop shooting you, has immunity.
That's
immunity or slavery. Now think about that. The greatest crime in the modern human era is not the Holocaust or the Shoah, it's the Ma'afa. What happened to us? What happened to Israeli Jews? And I don't mean to be comparing like this, you know, like it's a competition, but what happened to Jews happened for 11 months. Hitler killed Jews for 11 months. He killed 6 million Jews in 11 months and 4 million other people in 11 months. Rwanda had a higher rate of murder in 1994 than the Shoah. The Ma'afa, M-A-A-F-A, is our Holocaust that we went through. And that's why I love brothers like you, Elliot, who you're going to go down, brother, loving our people. You're going to go down speaking for our people. You're going to go down writing for our people. You're going to go down with your platform for our people. You're going to go down. When you're done, our people are going to be in a better position than you found us. And if we could multiply brothers like you, you know, 1,000 times, you know, we would raise the consciousness of our people on a much higher level. Because, again, this reparations thing ain't about slavery. It's about everything that you did in addition to slavery. And I was alive when black women couldn't vote. Black women got the right to vote in 1965. I'm older than that now. You know, what are you going to do for them sisters who finally got the real federal protection in 65 that the white women had in 1920? Again, I think reparations, like James Baldwin explained, white people have a racial problem. We don't, black people, we may have a colonial problem, brother, but we don't have a racial problem. The racial problem is theirs. At this point of our maturity as humans, at this stage of where we are as humans, with the technology, like the internet, they can no longer project themselves as anything other than regular people like everybody else. Y'all are not superior. Look at Donald Trump. That's evidence that y'all are not racially superior. That's about as inferior as you can get, as awful of a white man as you can offer up. Put Obama next to Trump, and you may disagree with some of Obama's policies, but just forget, put the brother next to this man, and you see, I don't see no master race, you know, that Trump proclaims. I think, you know, what we have to do as a people at the local level is organize the way we've been organizing around the issues that are important to us, whether it's guns, health, seniors, orphans, schooling, Black people don't want nothing magical, Brother Elliot. We want reparations because that is what you owe us from the crimes you have committed against us. It's not like, and again, Brother Elliot, we're not saying white people owe us reparations. We're saying white people ain't important in reparations. We're saying the American state is the a criminal, the offender, the defendant. And remember, Charles Ogletree, the great Stanford and Harvard Socratic method scholar, who was a professor of the Obamas and the Val Patrick and a few others, and Johnny Cochran, their approach was to go to the courts. They were going to try to undo McAdoo or challenge it in some way. And we need young black lawyers like Brian Williams and others, you know, Vanita Gupta, to step up and start another reparations legal challenge for the legal front. What we did in the city and in the state, and this is how imperfect it is, we went to the criminal to say, fix us for what you've done, even though you won't acknowledge that you've ever done it. Again, San Francisco is thinking about apologizing now, so they're not even admitting it yet. So you know, it seems to me that, you know, what black people should be doing everywhere. I don't care what your other, you know, politics are. You gay, be gay and advocate for black reparations. If you're a black feminist, be a black feminist and advocate for black reparations. If you're a black Marxist, be a black Marxist and advocate for black reparations. Nobody black should be talking about any kind of politics other than reparations at this point, because there's nothing else to talk about. What are we going to continue talking about, Brother Elliot, 10 years from now? Welfare? Affirmative action? We're going to let them keep playing with us with that crap? They've been playing with us for 40 years, 50 years. Welfare, affirmative action. And we both know the number one beneficiaries of affirmative action are white females. But they keep playing like it's us benefiting from it. So reparations for me is a final solution for black people. It's us saying once and for all, this is a magic bullet. Yes, reparations would heal black America, but I think reparations would more heal white people more than it would heal us, because they got the sickness. We don't got the sickness. We don't have the sickness. Individuals amongst us may have the sickness, but as a people, we don't have the sickness. As a people, they got the sickness. They got individuals who don't have the sickness. With us, it's just the opposite. We don't have the sickness, and a few of us do.
Let me get these calls on before we start winding things down, because Professor Taylor's he's on fire. Hold on a second. Let me go to Philadelphia.
Yeah. Hey, Brother Elliot, how you doing?
Yes, sir.
Hey, I'm doing. Hey, Brother Richard, hi, Professor Taylor, how you doing, my brother?
I'm doing great, brother.
Praise be to Allah. Yeah, Professor Taylor, you know, I agree with you that Dr. West should definitely talk about reparations. But I think he can do both. I mean, we're walking through government to say he can talk about reparations. He can talk about Palestine and Israel too. But he definitely, as part of his agenda, should definitely be mentioning reparations. I agree with you on that. No doubt about that. I agree. We're on the same page on that. He should definitely be part of this thing. Now, where I disagree with you on, I don't see this enlightenment with Biden and Buttigieg. I just don't see it. I mean, I'm just being honest with you. I don't see Buttigieg, you know, whatever that stuff he should be knocking down these things. I just don't see it with him. I don't. Maybe you can throw me in, Professor Taylor, on Buttigieg. I trust him as far as I can throw him.
Yeah, no. Just real quickly, if you look at the details of the Build Back Better plan, the BBB plan, it is going into places like Newark, New Jersey. You know, we have Brother Ross Baraka. Amiri Baraka's son is the mayor there. Mm-hmm. But if you look at what some of the racist planners and urban planners did, they would make overpasses low so that the buses couldn't go through them. Okay. And those buses had our mothers on them. Your mother and my mother, who worked for white folk in their houses as domestics, they were on the buses, like Rosa Parks. And they made the bridges low, the overpasses low, so the buses couldn't bring black women to work. And those are the kind of things that Biden and Buttigieg is going after. I'm not endorsing Biden, brother. I'm just trying to get people to understand. There are some things that they at least are targeting. Again, my beef was they won't call it reparations, but that right. to me would be part of reparations, would be going and destroying everything that was anti-black in America. You know what I'm saying? Whether it was a freeway or a loan policy, you know, or you know, anything that hurt, that targeted our people to take right. from us, to rob us, should be reversed. And again, I got the same skepticism you have towards Biden completely. Right. I'm not endorsing him. I'm just a political scientist trying to acknowledge that the policies, you know, that he's outlined around development is nothing like we've ever seen before, not even FDR, LBJ.
Well, you know, Professor, I heard what you said because it's the same with Obama. No, everybody knows I'm no big fan of Obama's, but even though he didn't do this for black people per se, but with the Obamacare, the medical plan, affordable right. health. I mean, it definitely, I can't deny it's a good thing because I know friends of mine, black, right. Latino, whatever, who never had health insurance in their life, they do have some form of health insurance because, Lord, you know yourself, Professor Teller, the way these hospital bills is, man, if you didn't have some kind of health coverage, you couldn't afford it. Unless you're rich, you couldn't afford it. So I definitely agree with that. That's one of the
things. Think about anybody, and this is so black, that's what I'm saying. Like, a lot of black folks ain't paying attention to how black-specific some of these policies are. They can't call it what they want, you know, like reparations. But right. the idea of them putting a cap on insulin at $35 a yes. month.
Mm-hmm.
Think about your grandmother, my mother, your mama, Elliot, your mama, your aunties, your uncles who had diabetes. That's us.
That's true. You're right, Professor. I can't deny that, Professor. Tell.
So, I'm not sitting here asking people to, again, I'm not a Democrat. I've never been a Democrat or a Republican. I've always been a black independent. I've always been independent as a black man. Right. And that's my politics. But as a student of political science, I look at what's going on in, exactly. you know, in the realm of politics.
Sure.
And Biden has a very impressive domestic agenda that is targeting black America.
Right. And I heard what you're saying because, you know, see, I like what you call yourself, Professor, independent, because like I said, when you look at the father of see, that's why I say we get so caught up in the party thing because, see, the father of affirmative action was after Arthur Fletcher, who was with the Nixon man. He was a black man who was the author of affirmative action, the same affirmative action that people like Tim Scott and all the mother, you know, Negroes right. trying to destroy. But it actually was a black man in the Nixon administration, Arthur Fletcher. See, so I can say, it's not, I'm like you, Professor Tao, I don't get caught up in the party labels. If a man, right. black man, or black woman can help our people move forward, whether they're Democrat, Republican, or whatever, they can help our people move forward, I'm okay with that. You know what, that Professor, let me say this last thing on that overpass. You know, made me think, Professor Tao, you're absolutely right about that. Again, I'm no fan of Buttigieg or Biden. I have too much, you know, respect for either one of them, but the point is, something that's going to benefit our people, I'm down with, because they're overpass. Remember about maybe 15 years ago, Professor Teller, I forgot what city it was in, where this, and it goes back to what you said about overpass. The overpass was so low that a double-decker yeah. bus came yeah. by, and the people got, that was on the, they got killed. They got killed because the overpass wasn't big enough for the double-decker bus to go through. So you make a good point, yep. Dr. Teller. You're right.
Let me recommend this to you, because I do this with my
sure.
students. I actually go online to YouTube and just Google, like, is the freeway racist?
Mm-hmm.
Google the phrase or the sentence or question, is the freeway racist or racist freeways? And watch
okay.
it come back to you. You're going to see in St. Louis, you're going to
okay.
see in Detroit, you're going to see in Philly, Boston, Chicago, L.A., New York, Oakland, everywhere where we are, they did
yes.
this to us.
Yes, I'm going to do that too. And I believe, I'm going to definitely Google that, Professor Tucker, because you're right. Those are things that people need to know about. I mean, you make some good points.
My students are mostly white and Asian. When I showed them this the other day, it blew their mind. They're like,
I'm sure.
They're having to say to me, Ann, are you crazy? How are the freeway going to be racist? When I got finished, they were like, damn, I didn't see this before.
I know that's right, Professor. I know that's right, man. Again,
sometimes the overpass, sometimes the bridge, sometimes the expressway is
right.
racist.
Wow.
That's how deep racism is. They built streets and schools. Brother, we all have heard this since we were babies.
Yes.
The other side of the track, the wrong side of the track.
You're absolutely right.
That's a metaphor. That's a metaphor for that reality.
Yes, Yes. And like I said, Professor, you open my eyes up to something tonight. I mean, you made me look at this thing a little different as far as, like you said, things that was done, whether it was intended or not. It's definitely helped our people out. So Buttigieg and Biden doing that, that's good. You know, like I said, I'm not supporting either one of them. But again, if that benefits our people, like I said, about Obamacare, yes. if that helps yes. my people get yes. any kind
exactly.
of insurance,
exactly.
Lord knows,
exactly.
my people
exactly.
benefit. I know some people that's glad they got Obamacare because they didn't
right.
have no insurance ever in their life.
Right.
So. Give credit and that's credit it. Where it's due. It benefits
that's
our
it.
People. Professor, thanks a lot for your time, brother.
Again, brother, I think we should advocate for reparations everywhere we are.
Yes.
Because, again, there's no argument against it anymore. Anybody offering an argument against it ain't studied. But anybody who studied what we did in San Francisco, what they did in California, Sacramento, they had a 1,300-page document. We had about a 200-page document. So you got 1,500 pages of well-documented injury of what California did to black folk. And you can
wow.
do it in Alabama. You can do it in Georgia. You can do it in New York. You can do it in Pennsylvania. You can do it in Michigan. You can do it all over the country because the state participated in our underdevelopment.
That's true.
And that's the key. They underdeveloped us, brothers.
Like
Walter Rodney did. And,
yes,
and
I know, underdeveloped
they,
Africa.
They
right,
yeah.
underdeveloped
us.
Yes,
if
right.
they left us alone, brother, we'd be all Tiger Woods. If they left us alone, we'd be LeBron James. If they left
that's
us alone,
true.
We'd be Carmelo Anthony. We'd be Obama.
Yes, yes.
We'd be Michael
right,
Jackson
right.
and Chris Brown. If they left
yes.
us alone, we became that in spite of them. But imagine
yeah, how about
they
that?
Left us alone. Think about Black Wall Street and Rosewood.
Yeah.
If they left us alone,
well, you know, Professor, that's so true. I look, Professor, what you're saying has got my mind just riveting because everything you're saying is right on point, Professor Thun. Again, thank you for your comments. And I appreciate your words of inspiration. Brother
that's
Elliot, put me on mute now. This is the rest of the show. Good stuff, Professor Teller. Good stuff.
Yes, sir.
Thanks for your call.
You're welcome. You're welcome, Brother Elliot.
Let's go to New York City. Hey, Professor Taylor, are you on the speaker?
Who? I was.
Oh, yeah, because your voice is muffled. But go ahead. Go ahead. That's better now. Go ahead, New York.
All right. Hey, Brother Taylor, you know, man, whenever I hear you, I think about New York, man. You need to maybe come back to New York and leave the West Coast, baby, because I don't know what they doing to you, but they doing something. Now, let me be clear on this. Are you saying that Biden is, in a sense, a savior for black people?
Oh, absolutely not.
Okay.
I'm saying, if anything, I'm saying that he's giving them a return on their votes. Biden, like Obama, I felt like, didn't owe black folk because they were black. He owed them because they voted for him twice. And he didn't give them the infrastructure, apart from, you know, the Health Care Act, which helped everybody. You think about Bush in 2004. Bush gave $3 billion in 2004 money to the evangelicals as a reward for their vote. So I would only argue that Biden owes black people because they voted for him and saved him in South Carolina with Clyburn. And they defeated, you know, Trump in Georgia and in Michigan and other places. But again, I'm not satisfied that Biden, even with the efforts of him and Buttigieg with the infrastructure, has done a job. So I was clear in saying, you know, I'm not endorsing him. I'm just acknowledging as a student of public policy, the policy angle, how it can positively how would it impact black people? So I would say Biden is just as racist as LBJ was. I'm clear on that, brother. I'm clear that Biden is as racist as FDR was. But the time... The time after George Floyd forced Biden far less than he ever intended to on race.
Okay, now you saying, because we got to clarify this. You're saying that Biden is rewarding black people with the infrastructure. In what sense, in area are you saying that Biden is rewarding people? Is he giving? Let me finish. Could I finish? You got to let me ask you the question. Is he rewarding black people with jobs? Is he rewarding black businesses with contracts? What is he rewarding them with? That's what I want to understand.
Again, I have a problem. I have a problem with the way the federal government counts unemployment, because all it means is people quit. People ain't got jobs, ain't looking for it no more. Unemployment rate is a lie.
Losing you, Professor Taylor.
Huh?
Okay, we got you now.
I was saying that we know the unemployment rate is a lie. We know the unemployment rate is people that just don't even try to get a job, that ain't got a job, and the job, you know, labor participation is a better measure. But if you believe the unemployment rate, which, again, is problematic, they claim, I haven't studied this, but they claim there's an all-time unemployment rate for black folk. Trump claimed it before, but Biden apparently is doing better than that. I think the infrastructure bill definitely was black-specific. I think it was aimed at undoing everything that has been done since the New Deal. That's what the Build Back Better plan is doing. It is going around and taking away bridges, freeways, highways, schools, all kind of things that were aimed at being anti-black. And most of us black folk, you know, don't know it. Half of what Robert Moses did in Harlem, in New York, what Robert Moses did with the whole system in New York, the whole highway and freeway system in New York was racist. How he wiped out entire parts of the black community. So I'm saying to you that Biden... Again, I don't want to be in a position of defending Biden, brother, because I'm closer to you than I am to Biden.
Nah, man. I'm trying to get...
Hey, Professor Taylor, let me say this. Hold on a second. Professor Taylor, let me say this in reference to that. Because it might seem as though he's doing stuff for the infrastructure in these cities where blacks happen to be. But a lot of that is being done because these cities are being gentrified. So... When these whites move into these areas, they don't want all that messed up infrastructure and bridges too low and all that. So when he's doing all these water systems and fixing pipes, taking lead out, fixing bridges, that's not necessarily for the benefit of black people. I would say
I agree with you, except that COVID chased the white folk away from American cities. COVID sent white folk back to the suburbs.
Yeah, but they in these cities, they coming in here. And plus, with that Build Back Better, you know, he supposedly is, because he's sending black elected officials now around touting all of these supposed things being done. But the major thing in that Build Back Better that was there because he wanted black votes and he got it, was that money, those reparations for black farmers for that discrimination and that land loss that they just pulled completely out. I mean, they just took the whole, they took a pen and just whited it out.
Wow.
Which caused John Boyd.
I did not know that.
Oh, yes. That the money for the black farmers that was in that Build Back Better was taken out because it was challenged by the white farmers all across the country. And then the banks went to Biden and said, "Well, we're not giving debt relief to black farmers." So all of a sudden, it was taken out. And then farm activists like John Boyd and others said, "Well, I'm not supporting Biden because this lie." And he came on the program and talked about it several times that he met with him personally, and the man lied to him.
Right. So I don't want to be in a position of defending Biden.
I know that you're not. But I'm just
for an analysis of policy.
I'm not defending him. I'm talking about Taylor.
Go ahead.
Ask your question. I'm sorry.
The funny thing about you, Taylor, I always get a kick out of, man, sometimes you remind me of the master switch talker, Eric Michael Dyson, the way y'all see that. But the thing is this, though, and this is real. I just would like for you to explain, in all sincerity and honesty, based on what happened out there with that reparations commission in San Francisco, L.A., and the continual movement in this reparations situation. In all sincerity, what can black people do to get reparations? Because my position is white folks ain't never going to give us any reparations unless they need the money back. So to me, I just think, and I haven't seen it start up yet, I just think they toy with black folks when it comes to reparations for the simple fact if they know, if they say to black people, well, we go set up a commission, we go do this, we go do that, black folks fall for it. But the sad thing is, I think they're going to mess up this time because you got one of the most evil, wickedest narcissists on the planet playing games with black folks that I don't think I've never seen a candidate do. I mean, if you really, and you're a political guy, I've never seen anybody in my lifetime play black folks and manipulate and con black folks the way Fredo Trump does. And, and if you listen to them closely, they talk about Biden age and his dementia and all that, which is really about something that takes it into a whole nother level. It's really about Kamala Harris. White folks don't want her to become president. That's the truth. That's the truth for that matter. Yep. But that's for another whole thing. But it's just amazing how this other individual is able to manipulate and con black people against what their best interest, because you know, and I'll leave it on this note, if he gets in the office, and if you know anything about Project 2025, it's a wrap for black people in this country.
Yeah, I heard about that.
It's a wrap. And the only reason I say that is because last week I made a comment, and a brother from Detroit called in, and he was quite upset about what I said, and I had no problem with it. I listened to what he said, and I did a little bit of research. I can't go into it now because you are on the program and whatever, but let me say this. Those companies that he was talking about, I checked out three of them, and I made a couple of calls to my brother in Detroit. Those black-owned companies that are billion-dollar companies, they don't even hire 25% of black people.
Wow.
Check that out.
Wow.
And we'll talk about it maybe next week. But think about this. These are billion-dollar companies that don't even hire 25% of black people. So think about when Project 2025 hit, and all of the other things that come into play, in all honesty, what position black people going to be in? Who's going to save us? That's all.
Brother Elliot, whenever this brother calls, he calls in Carl Nelson sometimes. And whenever he opens his mouth, I feel like I'm back home with my family in New York. Because his accent is such a strong New York accent. I'm from New York, but I ain't got that accent like he does. His accent.
That's why I told you to come back.
His accent made me feel like I'm in Harlem, like I'm back home. But he's always intelligent. He's always intelligent and asks intelligent questions and you know, makes strong interrogatives, if I can use that fancy word. And he's always challenging me. He's always pushing me. He's always like, say, Professor Keller, don't be giving us bull crap. And I respect that. I'm a fighter. He a fighter. So when it, you know, so with me, I'll fight back. But in this case, he's right 100%. I agree completely. And I love it. I love him because again, he has called in many times to disagree with me, and I respect that because it corrects me. I might be wrong, and I might need to look at what he's saying. I might need to check myself. Maybe I'm saying too much about Biden. You know what I'm saying? Like people might get the wrong message. It's like, you know. So I'm trying to be humble and accept that I'm not the smartest person in the room. And I respect his perspective. And that's about the most mainstream he sounded about the Democrats, because he's hostile toward both parties. So the fact that he said these things about Trump, you know, in a blunt way, I think it's kind of an urgency after Trump's recent comments. Again, I don't forgive Biden for saying, if you don't vote for me, you're not black. But what Trump said was similar. Like, I can only, I mean, how racist can you be? I can only see the black people in the room. Come on, y'all. Exactly. All we can do as black people is laugh, because it's funny to us. Like, this dude is really off the deep end. But then tomorrow, you're going to find a bunch of Republican blacks out on the internet, out online, trying to resuscitate Trump's recent racist expressions. But again, if you listen to Biden talk too long, he'll say the same kind of stuff. So, you know, the thing we got to do is use Biden. We got to use him like a mule, you know, to get what we want. If we want the George Floyd bill passed, and we want the John Conyers bill passed, we have to keep acting. We want reparations. We can't say, okay, they done in San Francisco, they done in California. It's like, oh, hell no. We're inspired by San Francisco. We're inspired by California. And we're going to do the same thing here in Oshkosh, or Des Moines. You know what I'm saying? And I mean, you got to remember, this all started with Brown University in terms of...
Well, let me say this, Dr. Taylor. Hey, listen, and thanks for your call, New York.
All right.
I agree what you're saying about we got to keep after them. But the way the system is set up, the way you keep after him is one of two ways. Either your representatives that you vote for... out of these localities, your congressmen, your state representatives, they have to keep after him for you because your mouthpieces. Now, if they don't, because a lot of them don't, they don't keep after. And in fact, they operate almost, they do what they're told. If you notice, black elected officials, they're not there. Listen, when Trump was running against Biden that first time and reparations was introduced in these political debates, sir. That was the first time any political debate before when they wanted to introduce it, when Obama said, well, I'm not interested in reparations. They didn't want to talk about it. So you didn't hear that much talk. But now you don't hear reparations being talked about by white candidates. And I expect that. But the thing is, you don't hear black elected officials talking about it.
Marianne Williamson, the white woman who doesn't have a chance of winning, but she is running on a reparations platform of $500 billion, which ain't enough. But I'm telling you that there is one candidate advocating reparations, and it's Marianne Williamson, a white woman.
Yeah, well, but what I'm saying is, in general, and I'm not telling you because you're a political scientist, but it's two ways that you can voice your disapproval. Either your black elected officials who you vote for is supposed to push these issues, or you don't vote for that person again. And you see now that black people is saying, I'm not voting for this guy. But the only thing, they're being courted by, like you said, another racist that makes dumb comments every time you turn around.
I don't think you can underestimate the impact of Biden hugging Netanyahu after October 7th. That turned black America off. It really alienated black people from Biden. It's like, what are you doing? Like, you siding with Hitler. Netanyahu is Hitler. How are you going to side with Hitler?
Yeah, well,
and we did side with Hitler too.
And the thing about it, when they're sending money over there, you got blacks in Congress that rubber stamp it and vote to send money and then make statements that they're in support of this, like Jeffrey Meeks, like Hakeem Jeffries. And then you got the other ones that are a part of the administration, like Linda Thomas Greenfield and others, that keeps putting a black face on this white aggression.
And if you look at the reparations program, every city where reparations is going on is a black mayor. L.A., San Francisco, Chicago, Oakland has an Asian woman. San Francisco has a black woman. And
There's one or two other black cities that are organizing around reparations, and they have black Democrats in place. And all of these black Democrats, think about the brother in Chicago, how he acted. Think about how he acted. He act like he don't understand black suffering. And he's so, I don't even know him. I haven't, you know, he ain't no Harold Washington. I know that much. And he didn't come from the black community as much as he came from other interests. The same way Lori Lightfoot before him didn't really come from the black community, but came from other interests. There's a problem, black people, we have with black politicians that won't come out and support reparations. Barbara Lee does. And you see what they did to her in California. They disrespected her. Gavin Newsom wouldn't give her an appointment to the Senate seat that was wide open to allow her the advantage of incumbency. And so now Barbara Lee's running against two white Democrats here in California, Katie Holmes and Adam Schiff, but from a disadvantage as a black woman. If you're a black woman running for office, you're already at a disadvantage, period. So you need all of the help you can get. And the Democrats dog Barbara Lee. But Barbara Lee supports reparations. I assume Maxine Waters does, but I haven't heard her say anything. Cori Bush,
you see,
in Missouri, has pushed about a $14 trillion proposal, but she ain't playing.
Mm-hmm.
Sheila Jackson Lee's taking up, you know, H.R. 40. Sheila Jackson Lee has sponsored that, but she's lost a lot of power in Congress, so she's weak there. So somebody else would probably take it over. Like, what if Hakeem Jeffries, who is the nephew of Professor?
You said where is he?
He's the nephew of Leonard Jeffries.
Oh, I know it. You said where is he on this issue?
No, I'm saying what if Jeffries, the nephew, the congressional leader, took up reparations? That would be amazing. And you know his uncle supports reparations. And you know he does.
He's too far in Israel's pocket. He didn't been there about three. I don't know how many times.
That's the problem with black politicians. We know, and I think we got to give some grace to black politicians, Brother Elliot, for a second. We got to recognize that the Jewish lobby, and I'm calling it that, AIPAC, has targeted black politicians with $20 million or more to defeat any black politician who ain't singing the song of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
The brother who's the actor, who's running for Senate, I can't think of his name right now. Oh, you're talking about it. I can't think of his name right now.
Hill. I think his last name is Hill.
Hill Harper. He came out and told on him. He said they approached me the other day for $20 million to run against the system for Senate. And they're going after anybody who, like the so-called squad, you know, AOC and them, Corey, the sister in Boston, you know, with alopecia, what's her name?
Presley.
Going after Sister Presley. They're going after every, and this is the sad thing. Like, I was at a public event recently in San Francisco, and I called out the Chinese community because they don't support reparations. And not only do they not support it, I have a student who works for a state legislator in San Francisco, but is based in Sacramento for the offices in the city. And she told me there was about 9 Asians per day coming into this Asian city, a state legislator's office, telling him at the assembly level, which is state level, to oppose reparations. We don't even know as black people who our enemies are. And I brought this out, and a white woman stood up and confronted me. This is last Sunday. She confronted me when I gave a lecture, and I pointed out that the Japanese community has been strong in support of reparations. And I want you to hear me. The Japanese community, they've been through it. They went through internment. They got reparations. Guess what? The Japanese community supports black reparations. The Jewish community supports black reparations in San Francisco. The gay community? Nope. Where they at? Right, Elliot, where the gay community at? And the Chinese community.
I don't know.
Right? And the Chinese community also, again, they were the main people that let this Jewish dude Bloom manipulate them in the case
at Harvard and North Carolina, where we were less than the Asian group at both schools. We were smaller in population, so we weren't hurting them. And they found out that it was these legacy white kids who were all unqualified to attend Harvard or get accepted at Harvard in their own right, based on their own records. All of the white kids at Harvard are unqualified. And now the Asians are finding out just 3, 4, 5 months later, brother. I'm sure you've seen this online. They are now regretting what they did at Harvard and University of North Carolina, because the numbers are showing that they are suffering. They are not. Their numbers have not improved now that they've gotten rid of us. And Asians and other minorities need to listen to black people. We've been here for 400 years. We know this system better than anybody else. Don't ignore us because we black. You better listen to us because we black.
Let me grab this last call. Let's go to Newport News.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Yes, sir.
Look, there's so much out here that you know how I am. What's up, Professor Taylor? Let me start with this. I sincerely believe part of the problem is no specificity in language. What's being done by most of these localities is an excellent job at racial equity work. Let me tell you why I say that. If you look at what's going on with all of the black groups, including some people I've worked with for over a decade, they took money from a place called Liberation Ventures. You can look it up. What did they do? They started out by saying that they were doing reparations in the now to help black advocacy for reparations. Now, let me tell you what they did. They got a bunch of corporations together to lend money, and I'm going to make a blanket statement whether people agree or not. Philanthropy and charity will never be reparations. Why? Because they cannot afford to foot the full bill. That comes from here to equality. Now, the latest book out is the Black Reparations Handbook. Page 5, Chapter 2. Daddy and his wife explain to you one of the crucibles of reparations. The perpetrator must not benefit. If you are having venture capitalists fund you and limit and control what can be said, then you are not getting reparations. You're getting a revenue stream that will not benefit the holder. Let me say something else. It is the same trick that people have gone through with these opportunity zones. I know a lot of black people, businessmen and stuff, that have been pushing for opportunity zones. Daddy has gone against them, whether they are publicly financed or public-private financed. Why? Because what it becomes is a revenue stream. The only entity that can supply the funding is indeed the federal government. Now, let me pivot where most people don't get. Rather than have this fight with people fighting about states and localities, and I put some stuff in the chat, and I hope you look across it, because I've been at this for a decade, and I'm old enough to just say what I see coming. When you have no respect for language, and you let what is civic engagement, what a person should get because of citizenship, that is exactly what all of these people are fighting for. And let me give you a prime example. From the start, and I've been at this for a long while, when the California Reparations Task Force started, some of the people I worked with were championing it and were trying to get me to go along with it. I refused to get involved other than make a few comments. Let me tell you what happened. Actually, the report came out. The research is done. They talk about we need a commission. They put out information not only relevant to California, but all across the nation. And everybody from across the nation, a lot of people I work with, I guarantee you at least 400 or 500 people that I've worked with in the last 10 years, were pushing for that. But they were demoralized when it went to the next stage where the assembly had to do some work. Now, both of those elected officials, I said it while it was going on, they gave hints that you may not get what you want. Now, let me talk about the 14 bills that they claim is in California reparations. I've been an abolitionist since the 80s when the government locked me up for a year and a day. So mm-hmm. I understand just how screwed up this system is. And then 2 or 3 years later, go to appellate court and tell me I was innocent. Hell, I knew I was innocent from the start. Didn't mean I could fight the apparatus. So it's still right. there. Now, my point is, the 14 things that they put up there, at least 5 of those things are not actual bills. Now, this is what I tell you about abusing language. You're a professor. You tell me you have 14 proposed bills. None of them have anything to do with cash reparations except people who have been harmed that can tie their roots back to land stolen through eminent domain. Talking about they came up with a new bill to try to put some money to that. But the other proposals, like the firefighters and the taking out the exception clause in the Constitution, those were proposals that those same assemblymen tried to get through the legislature 4 or 5 years ago. So they bring it back now and tell you it's a bill. But you know what you can do if you've been savvy at searching bills? Some of the 14 proposals don't even have a bill number. What's that tell you? Never been written, never come out of committee, never did nothing. So that's dishonest, in my opinion. People say no, but I'm old as hell. I grew up, I'm 70 years old. I grew up that if you don't know the five W's, who, what, when, where, and why, if they don't answer that, it's not a complete story. So they're giving you the impression that you're doing reparations. Now, here's my point. What I like about Liberation Ventures, even though I don't like what they're doing, is after I helped to have a campaign of going after them on Twitter, go back and read their new proposal. They don't tell you that they're pushing lineage-based reparations because they started out saying they wanted all voices in this arena being heard. Now what they've done is said we will give no funds to anyone advocating for lineage-based reparations. So by default, it becomes a rising tide piece of bullshit, and I'm going to say to you the same thing I said when I started the hashtag BHO, Legacy of Deceit. If you don't want to give cash payments for specific repair, you're bullshitting your populace. I'll stop there.
So can I ask you real quick, do you support the idea of reparations? Hello?
Bill.
My phone got messed up.
Okay.
On me.
Go ahead.
Without a doubt, sir.
Do you support reparations?
Oh, without a doubt. I'm telling you, I've been pushing and involved in getting as much privilege as I can from Dr. Derry. So, yes, I am a reparationist from the gut feeling. Abolitionist, reparationist. I don't think you can have one without the other. That's my personal take. But I am definitely for reparations. My point to you is, if you let them create revenue streams to enrich donors, you're not getting reparations because you will never, ever close the racial wealth gap.
I don't
believe that you can give reparations if you go to essentially what Narkin and Cobra want. They want what's called community-based reparations from me. And I'm saying to you, if each individual in the community does not receive cash payments in a capitalist system, nothing will change. Because, and I've said it before, and people call me ignorant, I don't mind that. At 70 years old in America, it ain't the first time. But my point is, they claim it's a class issue in our family. I'm not an expert on that, but I can tell you this. If you continue to give money to the upper crust and the postman, the garbage collector, even the outer work person, if they don't get some lack of precarity in their own household, there will not be full uplift for all of us. And that's what reparations should be.
It should be complete
uplift. And I'm saying to you, I think if you do something like Darity says, where you do a plan where everybody gets a certain amount of money from a 5 to 10 year period with the collective of activism that's been going on, I got enough faith in black people to all of us are not going to fail, and we can have some longevity in this country without being assimilated into it. I don't want to be absorbed into America.
I love this brother, Elliot.
Hey, well, look, you are a man
after my own heart.
Hold on, let me tell you how cold this is. And Elliot might boot me out for saying this. He cursed me out on our common ground one time, and I thought I was so long in America because I lost the audio, and I'm trying to get Janice to give it to me. That's how long I've been at this. I started out listening to y'all on Blog Talk Radio, driving cross country and stuff. I didn't expect to be able to sit down and be able to research it. But shout out to Elliot because I use his chat to put things in that you're talking about. And then when I go out in my community, I use this and I'm trying to drive people to this platform. I don't have to agree with everybody, but I think you have to interrogate all of these positions. I say again, my problem with the local is we're not focusing on the one thing, and this is the important part I want to say, and then I'll get out of it. The people I've been working with, I tell them, we tend to follow the news and all of the hot topics. But the truth is, in Washington, D.C., they have a reparations commission. And every damn citizen across the nation has a stake in what goes on in that District of Columbia, where for decades, for years, black citizens could not vote for their president. So now you're talking about going into the federal space, and there they ended up reinforcing this because I had a conversation with him before the D.C. commission. And he went in our D.C. reparations commission, and he told them, this is the only local reparations I will support. Why? Because it is federal funded. It actually could be a model for how you get things through in Sacramento, in California. Because if you focus on making sure that D.C. gets that model right, then we go through the part of getting rid of these lost cause grads like Jim Crow Joe and the immigrant that is Donald Trump. All of these people adhere to lost cause fans. I'm from Yorktown, Virginia. I grew up with it. My family is 6-7 generations in with the same white folks that owned us. And I used to make a comment to all the black people I met once I went into the military and traveled around this country. We are the Negroes that did not run. We have no reason to appease white folks. And we're not going to get reparations without offending and having some casualties on both sides because white folks are taking this shit serious. Have a good night. I appreciate your work, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you for your contribution.
Go ahead, Elliot. Go ahead.
Yeah, listen, Dr. Taylor, we didn't keep you over time, man, but it's always good having you on to share information with us.
Let me respond to that real quick. That brother is on fire. I love his passion. He's 70 years old. He's been fighting. Those are the people we need to respect and honor and not be distracted by celebrity. But everyday regular folk who are on the front lines trying to improve our condition. Reparations is about changing the relationship between black people and capitalism, black people and white people, black people and the police. The police the poor. And if we get reparations, it's going to take us from poor to middle class. And that's all I have a dream was about, was middle class. It wasn't about getting rich. And that's all, even our $5 million proposal in San Francisco. In San Francisco, if you work $5 million, you got a job. You ain't sitting around chilling. If you're in Alabama and you work $5 million, you chilling. But in San Francisco, you got to have a job. If you work $5 million, you got to keep it. If you're making $5 million a year, that's different. And so when we said $5 million, we wanted, that didn't come from the committee. That came from the neighborhood, the people. The people were able to talk in public comments officially, and they all recorded. And the people came up with $5 million, and they kept saying it, and then we embraced it. And what I think we did is we inspired people everywhere. And anybody looking to say, what did y'all get at San Francisco? Well, we got four things. They're doing a certificate of return program, which has been an ongoing issue where people that had houses that were removed by redevelopment had the right to go back into neighborhoods once they were redeveloped first. So that's the one thing Mayor Breed has been good on for black people is the certificate of preference, COP, to get them back into the... In other words, if your grandfather owned a house and your family got moved by redevelopment, your family, you would be able to say, well, look, I got my grandfather's certificate of preference, and we want this house. We want to move back in, or we want to move in. You can do that. So San Francisco is giving up four things. Another thing they're trying to do, I just mentioned earlier, is an apology, which I'm not impressed by, but they're offering. And there were two other items. I can't remember what they are. So we did get something. We didn't get nothing. And neither did California get nothing. And I think it's important to, again, recognize the way government works is once you get your foot in the door, you can begin to try to get more support for whatever it is. And hell, in San Francisco, this might seem like a tangent, but San Francisco, they have universal basic income for transgender people. Ain't nobody opposing that. Ain't nobody opposing them giving basic income to gay people or transgender people in San Francisco. So do it for us. They've given $50 to $60 million to the Chinese community, and they apologize to the Chinese community for past discrimination, the city council did, 9 months ago. And they ain't even organized. We organized, and they still make it difficult for us. So what it's taught me as a black man is how hard it is for us to get basic recognition. And that's why I think everybody under the sound of our voices should be organizing, involved, doing something. Whatever you can do to nudge black people forward, that's what you should be doing. Whether you want to call it reparations or just involvement, do it. Get involved. Help at the local level. Forget big answers, big solutions. Help a child read. Volunteer for foster, you know, help the kids in foster care. That's our kids. Those are our kids. Black kids, foster kids, our people. And they're neglected people. And this is something I've been educated on lately. We need to focus more as black people on foster care. And those, that might be your nephew, Elliot, in foster care. Because hypothetically, let's say you had a sister that was weak on drugs, and your nephew gets sent to the system. We need to reclaim those children and love them, and love them hard. That's what we need to do. Black people, we are beautiful, Elliot. You know we're beautiful. We're the most beautiful thing God has made on earth amongst human beings. We are the originators. We are the cream of the earth. We are a good people. We're not a bad people. We're not mean. We're not evil. Yes, we got crime. We got poverty. You know, we got brothers doing crime. That's not right. We all disagree with that. And the fact that when you go to church on Sunday morning, 99% of the black folk in there would disagree with, you know, bad behavior, let you know that we don't agree with certain things. We ain't happy about all this crime we're seeing, but we understand it. And I'm just saying, as a black people, we should be proud of who we are because of what we've been through and what we've overcome. And Ellie, I said this to my students the other day. My grandfather was born in 1895, 30 years after slavery ended. He knew his grandfather, but he also knew me for 5 years before he died. Now, you think about that. In my grandfather's life, he touched his slave ancestor and me. The future. And I wish he was alive so he could see what I've become. Because I honestly gave my life to my grandfather out of honor to him. And I think black folk have gotten too far away from honoring certain relatives in our families who we should honor with our lives.
Yes, I know? Agree with that. I agree with that.
So that's what I'm saying. We should be fighting for reparations everywhere and don't let apparent setbacks or what appears to be losses discourage you. Keep pushing. We're going to get reparations. Again, I told y'all, 40% of white people say yes to cash. Forget all the other stuff. In San Francisco, we had 111 issues. Cash was one of them. We had 111 issues. White people support most of those issues. They will support most of the reparations issues. Because they're right. Again, you cannot lose an argument or reparation anymore wherever you are because we've won the argument. Now the question is, will we mobilize as a people behind it? That's the key. We got to organize, mobilize, educate ourselves, read about Cali House, understand that reparations ain't some black militant idea. It was the original black idea after abolition. It was abolition, and then it was reparations. And we let it go after Cali House and Queen Audley Mother Moore. And I'm sure somebody's happy to hear me say her name, because she was the foremost Garveyite who promoted reparations. And we should throw up the names of Cali House and Queen Audley Mother Moore. Every black girl should know who Cali House is and Queen Audley Mother Moore. And we should not be brainwashed as a black people or pressured into thinking reparations is a bad idea or a radical idea or impossible. We have made major progress, people. 14 African and West Indian countries are openly, publicly demanding reparations from England and France and Portugal and Spain. I think we have something to do with that, Ellie.
Oh, yes.
I think we definitely did. Something to do with that.
They were inspired by what we did.
To be inspired. And that's all I got to say. I'm done. I thank you for this opportunity to talk. I hope I've encouraged people. I don't mean to offend nobody, but I just believe that black people in America deserve reparations like nobody else. And this country and the government knows it. And we have to stay organized, mobilized, pushing for it. And we need children involved. We need young kids involved to give them the seed of the idea so that when we all dead and gone, there's still a fight, just like we fighting in 2024 for reparations and Cali House been gone for 100 years. But if Cali House would wake up and see what we're doing in America, black America, y'all, I think people are seeing it as too much like disparate things. But if you add San Francisco to Sacramento, to Oakland, to L.A., to Asheville, to Evansville, to New York. We are involved in a new movement, black people. It's called the reparations movement. And you have got to get involved. Even if we don't get everything we want, we got to push for whatever we can get.
Richard.
Yes. Yeah. As I'm listening, I'm taking notes over here, so hold on.
Dr. Taylor, listen, we was glad to have you with us this evening. This ain't gonna, you know that your number is right there, and I'm gonna be reaching out to you in the future.
We good.
In fact, your colleague and friend, Professor Earl Henderson, called last week because he thought you was going to be on. I thought he was going to call tonight.
Brother. I love that brother.
But he's probably listening. That
brother. Oh, he got on me today. He got on me today. He's like, please see
you. Oh, he did? Well, okay.
He let me know, brother, you on today. He's like, make sure you get on today. So he's listening.
Hey, well, listen. Earl Henderson
is an amazing brother from Detroit. He went through hell at Penn State. He wrote an article called Being Black at Penn State University. Read that article, Google it. And he got serious repercussions. Even from black people in the NAACP came down on him. And it turned out he was right, because Penn State got exposed again and again before he stood up and after he stood up with this blatant racist incident. And he's good, but he's an outstanding scholar. He does international relations. He loves someone like Ralph Bunch down at Howard University. He studied under Haynes Walton Jr. and Harold Cruz. He's probably why I love Cruz. So I love Harold Cruz more than any other scholar. More than Du Bois, I love Harold Cruz. And it's probably because of Earl Henderson.
Listen, I want you to call back on the 24th when we have Dr. West with us.
You know, I need a reminder, though. I need an email.
don't worry. I'll do it. We'll talk.
Take care, brother.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
All right, take care now.
Richard, good conversation with Professor Taylor, he's always something when he comes on here. It's a good conversation.
Yeah, a lot of clarity.
And the thing I like about him, he's honest. If he don't know about a thing, he'll admit that I'm not aware of that.
Right.
But I'm going to send him some information on what was done with the farmers, because that's something he said that kind of got by him. And I think it would benefit him to know that whole backstory. Well, it ain't really a backstory, but that whole story about what went on with our farmers that's ongoing now. Richard, before we leave tonight, just give the lineup on Time for an Awakening Media. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. African Perspectives with Brother Oshie. Always interesting topics and dialogue with African Perspectives. That's Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Later on in the week on Thursday from 9 to 10, Mississippi on the Move, the Black Liberation Movement down in Mississippi. Brother Patrick Lumumba, Sister Crystal Denise, Brother Rodney Lowe, Brother Dubsack. You know, this Thursday, Richard, they'll probably recap that town talk. I think they're having the sixth leg of their 10-city town talk tour on Monday in Greenville, Mississippi. So I know he's going to recap it on Thursday. So that organizing that Professor Taylor was talking about is going on in a lot of different places. And Time for an Awakening is back on Friday from 8 until Saturdays from 7 to 9, the Elders of Sankofa with Dr. Janine James as host. And then on Sunday from 7 until Time for an Awakening is back. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of the thing that they'll soon be right at the heart of. My little Tommy, he said he wants to be a fireman. Problems. Oh.
children, to save the children.